It's called a meeting to order, and let me just tell you what the procedure is going to be for this morning. We have House File 3997, which came to us without recommendation, so we are going to take a little more time to do a hearing on that. And just because there are folks that have wanted to testify, we will make sure we are fair and say that each side gets exactly 1 half hour. Because after that, we will have House File 863, and we will just look at the financial parts of that. That's had 5 hearings thus far. This first hearing is informational only. It is coming to our committee, but at this time of session, with all the bills out here, some things are processing a little slower than others, and this just simply hasn't processed yet. So we will do an informational hearing. We did this last year when we did our omnibus bill, and because things were slow in processing at the end, too. So with that, we welcome you to the committee, and if I cannot move the bill, but we will take care of that at a later time.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members this morning. Just to be clear, Madam Chair, when you say 30 and 30, are you intending then no discussion among the committee then and holding off your discussion to later?
I think not. I think we will just have 30 and 30 because we have our committee hearing.
Okay.
That's the limits of the time we have.
Well, what I'm asking about is so you're not going to have discussion among your committee? Or during the 30-30?
No, during
the 30-30. We'll try to keep ours to 20 then.
Okay.
So then we have kind of 20-20 and maybe the discussion time or follow-up questions, et cetera. Okay. Good morning. Many of you heard this bill about, I guess, 3/4 or so of this committee overlapped with the policy committee that heard this last week, so I'm going to make briefer on the introduction of the concept of this bill. This bill raises the question of whether future landfills in our state should be allowed to be sited on areas that are known to be geologically highly sensitive to groundwater contamination. I provided this, so it's about drinking water and future drinking water supplies for communities throughout our state. I raised as a case study in this overall issue in my community in the East Metro. My community in the East Metro that runs from the South Hill of Stillwater down to the northeast portion of Woodbury and river towns from Stillwater, Lake St. Croix Beach, St. Falls includes Lake Elmo, West Lakeland, Baytown, etc. So a good chunk of the East Metro and Washington County in the midsection. These communities have been struggling with a variety of pollution plumes over the last 50 years from multiple sources. They have a PCE plume that was from a commercial site on a private property that created a plume running from Lake Elmo all the way to the river, affects 3 or 4 communities, has required special filtration systems in individual homes and also entire cities. This area also, as you know, has been exposed to PFC pollution in 3 of its aquifers throughout the region, affecting up to a 90-mile square area or so with a variety of different PFCs, the largest one, most recent one, being the discovery of PFCA in a large portion of South Washington County. In addition to that, there's a proposal, which you heard about last week, to site a new landfill in West Lakeland Township, which is almost the center of my district, which has the PCE plume just to the north of it and also has the PFC plumes affecting the area south of it. In all these instances, where the commercial site is that polluted years ago with the PCEs, where the Washington County closed landfill site in Lake Elmo, 3M sites that are in other parts of the area that have led to plumes, and also this new site that's being considered for a different type of landfill. In all these cases, most likely, I haven't checked all the 3M sites, we are talking about former locations that are on sites that have high sensitivity to groundwater contamination because of their geologic makeup, fractures, the type of soils, position roughness with the aquifers, etc. So the concern here is this good state policy to continue to allow siting in these types of locations? We know from the closed landfill program alone that that program is now estimating a couple hundred million dollars for future needs of this program. This one site in Lake Elmo had estimates from remediation that went from $7 million to $200 million to remediate in various ways. So we do know that when things go awry, and our approaches to containing these materials don't work in the way we had hoped they would in the past, or if they don't in the future, that it is a considerable cost to individual households, to cities, to counties, and to the state in the end, in some of these cases, in areas, in the cases where the state has taken on the responsibility. So this is about protecting groundwater, about preventive measures to protect the state and others from future costs that might be associated with pollution from such landfills. The issue in terms of what we're intending today, as you mentioned, we'll go into the language. There is a new version with slightly different language addressing some of the issues that were raised in the last committee. But before we go to the specific language today, I want to talk about a couple other things. First of all, as was mentioned last week, PCA, there are some federal rules that govern landfill siting. There are PC state rules that both for solid waste and for industrial sites. I and other staff, including my test choirs, have looked through those rules. Bottom line, when one looks at those rules, they don't prevent siting on highly sensitive groundwater contamination. And that raises the question, well, and then I asked them about that last week, and they said, well, we can engineer around that. That's the answer. My answer to that was, as I indicated, whether it was the 3M sites over the many years or the Washington County closed landfill site that was a state responsibility, or the current remediation on the TC plume, all of these are very tricky to engineer the remediation and also the upfront protection. Clearly the technology has changed over the years, but my community has a pretty low confidence at this point in whether these rules are adequately protected in the past and will do so in the future, and whether the newer engineering solutions being offered really provide the very long-term protection that they are seeking for their groundwater supplies. In addition, one other comment about the West Lakeland site, and well, it's true of many of the other sites I mentioned as well, surrounding and north of and south of this community, most of the properties are large lots, you know, 2.5 to 10 acre type properties or more. There is no city water supply. They are on private wells. They will be for years. And so if something does go awry, and if there is a problem, if there is pollution in the aquifers, there's no city water well someplace else that water could be piped through to these communities. They do not have the density to do that. So any pollution problem would be affecting their primary source of water in these communities. And there's no ready alternative to that. In terms of PCA in terms of the rules issue and whether they were adequate. In addition, PCA sent a memo to me yesterday directly in response to this bill, which I imagine if they haven't passed out or given to some other way, we'll probably verbally comment on today. Just briefly, and I'll have other experts address the things they raised. I must say I have been trying to remain very objective as a new legislator this past year in dealing with my constituents, with the legislative process, with information committees, and with the state agencies. Even when other legislators were cynical or about the nature of our agencies and some of the information they sometimes provide, I tried very hard to remain objective and open-minded about the working of our state government. I must say, when I received the memo yesterday in terms of what they said in it about the implication for this bill, one of their statements was so factually incorrect and easily refuted, and their argument so weak in its nature that it raised questions to me about the competency of some of what we are receiving from that agency and maybe possibly what their intent is here. But I will let others address those specific issues. Third, I want to comment briefly about some of the arguments that were made by, or comments that were made by Xcel Energy when they stood before you, sat before you last Thursday in reference to this bill. First of all, just for clarity, and I wish more of you were here now to see this, but to talk about this, is they held up a piece of the fly ash. A chunk, looks like a chunk of rock. Okay? And yes, fly ash, when wet, becomes a hard material. I want to say a couple things. First of all, in response to this draft environmental impact statement on this site, over, I think, 70 different groups or individuals wrote comments. Three of those, at least, were from engineering firms who critiqued this EIS for other parties. Engineering firm Bar Consulting was hired, Geo Hydro in Colorado was hired, and also COR was hired by Valley Branch Watershed, by West Lakeland Township, and by ACID to comment on the EIS. In all three of those consulting firm reviews of this EIS, of which I read this weekend, the many pages of those, all of them were highly critical of, in particular, the groundwater modeling portions of the EIS. Critical challenged whether the model used was even appropriate for that use, it wasn't intended for that use, that type of a purpose application, challenged the assumptions that were used in the modeling, and many other features of the inputs, outputs, and outputs of the modeling. In the very first page of one of the consultants' reports, the very first paragraph, they raised the question of why we were only looking at sites for siting such a landfill that were highly sensitive to groundwater contamination. So again, in terms of just the work that's being done to evaluate the site by other folks, focus has been on the ground potential for groundwater contamination and whether the analysis being done by our, having been done by our agency is adequate to address those issues in any way. In addition, the consultants directly addressed the issue of the nature of fly ash and the particular fly ash that may be coming forth from King Plant for this site. Number one, one of the main criticisms of the EIS is that we do not know the composition of this fly ash and will not know it for some time. It does not exist yet, and they do not know the composition. We just know that the composition will be higher in mercury and metals than previous fly ash because of a new type of scrubber. So one of the major criticisms is that we really don't know the composition of this fly ash yet. Finally, since they held up the piece of the fly ash rock, and Representative, I think it's Poppy, who's sitting over here last time, raised the issue, well, how could that be harmful if it's a piece of rock? Okay? So I'd like to read this quote to you, one paragraph from the report from Geo Hydro, a consulting firm that specializes in this area. The second paragraph of this section describes fly ash as an inert material. This is incorrect. Were it inert, it would not leach contaminants into water that comes into contact with it. Fly ash is a highly reactive material beyond merely leaching contaminants. It frequently shows pozzolanic properties, whereby water reacts with the ash to at least temporarily cause the ash to set up in a manner reminiscent of plaster. Studies have also shown that over time, continuing chemical reactions within fly ash cause the material composition to evolve over time, a process called ash vaginosis. Vaginosis occurs within fly ash over periods of years as water penetrates, the fly ash is hydrated, and the material seeks an equilibrium condition. These properties of fly ash do not describe an inert material. Moreover, we know from the DEIS that the leachate predicted because we actually don't know the composition of fly ash, the leachate that's predicted to come from this site would not meet our clean water rules and yes, could not go into the water because of the contaminants contained in it. So we're not talking about an inert material, we're talking about a material that is penetrated, that does hydrate, that does diagenesis, means that components are removed for it from it as water penetrates it and goes through it. Okay. One last point in terms of the issues that were raised in our last meeting, the issue of what other options Xcel might have. against disposing of fly after the site close to its facility. It would require much of that area probably is maybe high sensitivity groundwater contamination. We don't know how it would hold up to the test indicated in this bill. But if in fact it were and it did not meet the test in this bill, they would possibly have to truck this ash away in some other form than their at a greater cost. I cannot go into all the issues raised by this and other conversations that have been held about this particular site. This bill is about something greater than this. But since they raised the issue of the other options and the cost of trucking, let me just say that my own critique of the property value impact assessment in this EIS, being someone who used to teach contingent valuation theory in cost benefit analysis classes, which is the type of theory used to do property value impact assessment, that I found the property value impact assessment, which they concluded would have zero impact on property values, completely, entirely not useful for the purpose that they intended it. It's many, myself and others feel it was a study that provided, was not done in an appropriate way and did not provide the information that was needed for the study. I raise that because doing that properly in itself, in my view, would result in a decline in property values potentially in this area of greater value than the cost of trucking this to another site. So that alone, so the question is, who do you want to pay, them or the Washington County taxpayers? So, I mean, it's very complicated. There are many issues, but there are other options. They may be more costly, but we're talking about the long-term potential cost of having groundwater pollution, number one, and whether or not their cost analysis of even the impact and other aspects of the community are valid and justify the lesser trucking cost. Moreover, the key thing, back to my original point for bringing this legislation, is that this analysis only looks at sites that were high sensitivity to groundwater contamination. And therefore, the only factor that made one site preferable to another was trucking distance and the cost of trucking. So only that economic consideration was the primary determinant of the outcome of this type of analysis. That does not, in my view, adequately protect the state, the county, or the surrounding communities from future costs and hardships from possibly of groundwater contamination down the road in the future. In addition, this proposal, I believe, if I remember all the details correctly, requires only a 20-year kind of monitoring of the water after capping of this landfill, which is making the assumption that the tear of the liner or the break would occur just before that 20-year period started, okay, if you only wanted to work for 20 years. So just a few points on that. I'm now going to ask my geologist from the Geologic Survey to come up to talk about the specific language in the bill. As before, it has three major components. Sorry, on line 1.4 in the what will be able to read all when the committee takes it up formally. Again, is a test for evaluating in a site-specific way whether or not there is a high sensitivity groundwater contamination. Paragraph B, 1.14, kind of puts the threshold for that test and when it would be inappropriate to issue a permit for that. Paragraph C, 1.17, again, it has an appeals process. We acknowledge fully one of the points made by TCA that tritium testing alone is not conclusive. Tritium can flow from horizontally from another location, etc., and that's what this process is for in paragraph C, to address the science around the exceptions that might exist where the just simple test would not be sufficient information. In addition to that, we have added other language raised in response to some of the issues raised last week. Specifically, we have, first of all, paragraph D, actually this is not in response to last week, what the appropriate tritium value actually will change over time, and paragraph D provides the basis for adjusting it over time as needed based on the science. Paragraph D, this is, addresses one of the issues raised last week, and that is that this would not affect this bill. The proposals to expand existing landfill facilities. With that, I turn it to the Gail Federholm, the Assistant Director of the Minnesota Geologic Survey.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the representative has outlined here, our role here is to provide technical expertise. What we are asked to do is try to come up with a screening tool that would identify hydrogeologically sensitive areas that are perhaps not appropriate for siting landfill. We came up with a relatively affordable test that's easily accomplished and that we think would, in fact, have the effect of identifying sensitive sites. Since that time, we have received this document from the Pollution Control Agency indicating some objections to this test, and I'd like to address those now. Their first comment is that most shallow aquifers and even upper bedrock aquifers can be expected to have tritium values of 5 units or more. I certainly expect that many shallow aquifers and some upper bedrock aquifers would have tritium values higher than 5 units. The point of this screening tool is to see that landfills are not coincidentally located with shallow aquifers or vulnerable bedrock aquifers. That's what we're trying to accomplish. It goes on to say that using tritium as a screening tool as proposed in the bill would not allow a new solid waste facility to be sited anywhere in the state. And I disagree with that on several counts. Looking at the state as a whole, there are certainly places where bedrock is not an aquifer, or a bedrock aquifer is not located within 150 feet of the surface. In either of those cases, the bedrock requirement would not come into play. In a similar fashion, there are many parts of the state, in my experience, where a superficial aquifer or an aquifer in the unconsolidated materials is not located within 150 feet of the land surface. And again, no testing would be required if those aquifers are not encountered. I would go on to say that there are many places in the state where we cannot find an aquifer, certainly not within 150 feet of the surface. In those cases, no testing would be required, and this bill would not eliminate that ground. So there are certainly are places that would still be available. As for those places where we do encounter aquifers at some depth from the land surface, I referred to the Hope County Geologic Atlas completed 2 years ago. 77 tritium samples were run in that county. To be specific, aquifers occurring at the land surface were not tested. We expect them to have recent water containing tritium. Again, we don't feel that a superficial aquifer is the right place to locate a landfill. As for buried aquifers, those that are separated from the land surface, as I said, 77 samples were taken. 48 of them detected less than one tritium unit. The limit in this bill is 5 units, so they are well below that. That accounts for 62% of the samples that were tested. In the presentation of this data, they're categorized by tritium content. There are those samples with less than one unit, those samples with greater than 10, and those samples between 1 and 10. So it's difficult for me to say exactly where that 5 unit falls. But if we take that middle group, those with tritium content between 1 and 10 units, split it in half, that would add another 13% of the samples that would pass this test, or overall 75% of the tests run would not cause a problem for siting a landfill. So there's an example. I wouldn't characterize Hope County as a particularly sensitive county, nor would I characterize it as particularly insensitive. It's not a bad model to compare with the rest of the state. The second part of the MPCA comment goes on to say that The presence of tritium in an aquifer is not an accurate indicator of aquifer vulnerability at a specific location or from a specific location. We agree with that. It is possible that groundwater can move laterally from an area where recharge does take place to an area where there is not vertical movement of the water. And for that reason, the bill allows for an appeal, in other words, for a geologist to explain the presence of tritium in the sample and how it addresses the vulnerability of the site. So we think we've dealt with that. Finally, there's a paragraph that explains to us how hydrologic sensitivity works and how it's related to the material between the aquifer and the land surface and its permeability and ability to transmit groundwater. It goes on to say that the current solid waste rules take this information into account when permitting solid waste facilities. I think the reason we're here is that we see sites being examined where these hydrogeologic conditions don't seem to be appropriate. And I, without presuming to speak for the representative, I think what we're trying to do is avoid spending a lot of time and money looking at sites that have some basic flaws to them. And we think that this test will help us accomplish that.
Madam Chair, we are ready to move on to the next portion and then yes, follow up with please. Questions back and forth. Thank you. Unless you have questions at this time for us on what we presented so far.
Why don't you finish up, because I think you are probably answering a lot of questions as you were going.
Well, that's in my sense that we finished up. Right? Just to go through those of you at 134, that the tritium test is outlined in the first paragraph of the bill. We think we've addressed the issues of not going retroactively to existing landfills or those that might expand, but to address, at least put the state on a better course for the future in terms of avoiding these high sensitivity sites. So let me move on to the next step.
Before you leave, is this next test chart for your bill?
No.
Then I do have a question.
The other side, yeah.
Okay, I do have a question for you. When you were talking about this, I know this bill covered the state, but I am looking at this particular Lakeland site. When you were talking about the Washington County landfill and its relationship to the site, the current landfill and its plume, will you just say that again? There's a plume coming from the Washington County landfill. How does that relate to the Lakeland site, or does it relate?
The Washington County landfill is north and west by several miles of the West Lakeland site. The combination of the Washington County landfill and the three 3M landfills, Oakdale, Woodbury, and Cottage Grove, combined those four landfills, the Washington have created plumes covering a 99 square mile area approximately. The Washington County closed landfill is a 20 mile or so plume that's mostly Lake Elmo and Northern Woodbury. That one, I don't know the final eastern boundary of it, may also plume over just south of the West Lakeland site, but certainly it's the case that all those plumes combined from the four TSC site landfill locations, the plume goes all the way to the St. Croix River and the entire east side of that area, south of this landfill. So whether it's from that particular landfill, I'd have to check the map, but the TSC plumes in general do encompass areas south and east of this landfill.
I thought that's what you said, and I just wanted to clarify that in my own mind.
Mm-hmm.
Are there questions from other members? Representative
here. Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could have the previous testifier come up, I had a question about the testing, and you mentioned Polk County, but Polk County is a fairly long haul for trucking. Dakota County is just across the river, so I'd like some maybe description of how the analysis, the tritium analysis, would play out in Dakota County, and we have some shallow sand aquifers in the Hastings area, and various different soils and depth of bedrock. So if you could just give a little detail on maybe Dakota County.
Madam Chair, Representative, the reason I chose Polk County was just because a lot of tritium testing has been done there recently. In many parts of Minnesota, there is not that set of data of tritium testing in particular. What we have done in many parts of the state is map the geology with an eye to understanding how groundwater exists and moves in those counties. The tritium test came up as a proxy for that mapping in areas where it has not yet been done. You mentioned the Hastings area, certainly a groundwater sensitive area. There are indications that contaminants from the land surface can easily reach the aquifers in use there, and that in fact has happened. I don't feel confident I can describe the geology of Dakota County as a whole. I expect there are areas where there are glacial tills that would afford some protection. There are other areas where I expect sensitivity would be relatively high. But a sensitivity map of the aquifers in Dakota County does exist, and we could go to that for more clarification.
Representative Stolze.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And this is for the, I guess I've got two or three questions here. One, since we've had no new landfills in the past 10 years, where in a 100-mile radius could something like this be sited? And then I'll save my other questions for after that.
Madam Chair, Representative, with my understanding of the geology of the area within 100 miles of that plant, there certainly are areas with glacial till at the land surface that low permeability material between the land surface and whatever aquifers exist beneath them. I don't want to be in the business of saying what the results of the test would be. I would be much more comfortable with the test being conducted. But there are areas of relatively lower sensitivity that have been mapped. And I expect that some of those would be suitable.
And as a follow-up, Madam Ms. Chair, I would like to see those on a map if possible. I mean, because we have no idea. This has to go somewhere. And the reason I'm so concerned about this is that in Little Canada, where I represent, we had assurances from the EPA, the Army Corps, PCA, DNR, that fly ash was just a perfect the landfill. It was a perfect material to go into an area. It was just really good, cheap, clean fill, and would be good forever. So we have an area that's maybe a half mile by half mile sited in an old wetland area that created an industrial park that now cannot hold a concrete building. All the buildings are metal. But what I'm getting at is that we've had assurances all through the years that this is a really good fill, and I'm hearing that now you're saying it's not a good fill, and I understand that with the scrubbers, we're getting different material in there, we're getting more mercury. But I'm just kind of concerned that nobody's going to want this material. I mean, we didn't want it, but it was cheap and it was free, and everyone thought it was fine, so we have this great area of fly ash, and I think it's something that we have to be concerned with, and I think that when we look at these sites, we have to look at where it's going to go, but we can't continually say that we can't have it in our backyard because we all use that power. So it would appear to me that anybody who gets jobs and all the wonderful things that happen from this power plant, we have to be careful that we take care of our own waste. And so when you say within a certain amount of miles there are sites, I would like to know where their sites are, and if in fact the power plant is looking at those sites, and if we're working towards a resolution of this problem so that we can take care of this material.
Representative Bond. Mr. Madam Chair and Representative Salty, in the last committee, and if we have one, we can pull it on again, we do have maps for 17 counties showing areas that are high, high, moderate sensitivity to groundwater contamination that the Geologic Survey has mapped. We held those up last meeting. In every county in the state, there are areas, he said, you know, look at the cool colors, there are areas in every county, including southeastern Minnesota, that are not considered high or high moderate at risk to groundwater contamination. What we don't have is a map of the tritium tests throughout those areas. So while we have tried to come up with a test that would be highly correlated to those maps, and therefore there would be areas in all of those counties and all those regions of the state that could, would be, one would think would be appropriate for siting a landfill, without doing the actual site testing, we would not know. We don't have a map of that. So based on the map, we know that throughout Minnesota, there are many, many areas appropriate for siting of landfills. Even it is more difficult in southeastern Minnesota, where it's more high sensitivity. Those areas are fewer in southeastern Minnesota because of those geologic conditions, but they, at least on the maps we have, they appear to still exist even in those counties, numbers of areas. In terms of the issue of the siting, this area in my community does already have an existing fly ash landfill. It's being filled up. That's why they're looking for a new one. But that's the old type of ash, and it was before we discovered, and there's some conclusion wells in Lake Island too, therefore we discovered all these other aquifer pollution problems in this region and in this area. So there is a heightened sensitivity to the risk of future contamination because of that. And this is a different type of ash. There's also, it's also a more secure system, you know, more highly engineered. So first of all, I think that there are areas within every county in Minnesota that will be appropriate for landfills under this approach. And if not, we can take a look at that in the future. But based on the mapping we have of the electric we've already done, that appears to be the case. Outside southeastern Minnesota, there's very large areas of the state, you know, much of the state that would be available. But the southeastern portion near the, between the two rivers is a little trickier. And so the concern here is, you know, do we want to take those risks going forward when we do have sites that are more geologically appropriate to possibly take on the, you know, longer-term risks, since we don't know the long-term capabilities of liners of these new systems. We don't have a lot of trust in the groundwater modeling that's being done, evidently, by a number of folks. And so, given all those things, the question is, do we want to take that chance moving forward? So I fully appreciate your issues about the cost of these things and having to, you know, weigh that when doing these kinds of analysis.
Thank you, members. I think it is time for anyone who would like to speak in opposition to the bill.
I just want to say while they're coming up, Madam Chair, that I did have other potential testifiers, but was only going to use them as needed.
Madam Chair, while we're coming up, can I ask one question?
Sure.
Thank you, Representative.
Yes.
In your analysis on this siting, have you and the companies testified that, about the trucking and the costs, and it's quite a large amount.
Yes.
Have you factored in the CO2 emissions that would come from all of that trucking, and how does that impact what we're doing in the global sense here of trying to reduce CO2 emissions?
Mm-hmm. I have not addressed that issue, and to my knowledge, no one has. I don't believe it was contained in the trucking options that were in the EIS, EIS that was done. So the answer is no.
Thank you. Yeah. I think we are going to be careful now to for folks who would like to speak in opposition, and if you would like to come up, please.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Roger Clark.
Can you say your name again, please?
Excuse me?
Just say your name again.
Roger Clark. My name's Roger. Good morning. My name's Roger Clark. I'm a manager of environmental services with XL Energy Department. I have 20 years of experience as an environmental scientist. My group is responsible for siting and permitting of new ash disposal facilities. We're responsible for development and implementation of compliance assurance programs, and we've recently taken on the role of managing the contract operations for some of our ash disposal facilities. We have successfully sited fly ash landfills under the current regulations and believe that they are the best, most appropriate way to protect the environment, to protect the health and the environment. The current proposed legislation represents a significant change in the current process and will have a significant impact across the state. The proposed bill establishes a criterion, and it is a criterion, for the permitting of new ash solid waste disposal facilities, which effectively preempts the ability for the MPCA and other state agencies to use sound science in order to make these decisions for us. Under the current regulations, the DNR uses the water pollution sensitivity criteria and the guidelines as a screening tool to indicate where there is sensitive, highly sensitive groundwater, and we use that information to determine or to support land use, recreational protection, or resource protection decisions. General landfill siting process, this information is taken into consideration along with many other factors such as the characteristics of the waste that are being placed in the landfill, the facility design, and the way that we're going to be operating those landfills. If the project appears to be suitable, and that's during the screening process, then the design of the landfill, the operation of the landfill, the way it's going to be operated, and the monitoring criteria that are developed and presented to the agency in the form of a solid waste permit application. The agency then reviews the data and completes an environmental and engineering review of this information and evaluates the community, and under the permitting system, they conduct a complete evaluation of all the factors to make determination if a proper safety is achieved. The permit process, as you know, has several public and technical review processes to ensure that safety precautions are enacted. Under the current permitting process, sensitivity to groundwater and surface water contamination is a key consideration in determining whether the proposed site is acceptable. We believe that the acceptability of the proposed project should be based upon the evaluation of all site specific criteria, which includes the nature of the ash and the operation of the facility, and to arbitrarily exclude a site based upon the proposed criterion has potential to eliminate potentially good candidate sites from landfill processing or landfill siting process. Our current proposal is, of course, for the new King Ash landfill, and it's a good example of the process and what happens once the susceptibility of a site has been determined. First, as to the waste that we're proposing disposal, you all know that it's fly ash. Fly ash presents fewer risks. I don't know that we're trying to identify it as being inert material, but it provides fewer risks than other waste materials that are generated within the state. This of course is a factor in the permitting process. We have designed the facility to provide adequate protection for the safety of the environment and for the public. This includes a composite liner, which is comprised of a clay and plastic liner. It also includes a leachate collection system, which has sand and pipes, the intent of which is to eliminate the leachate or water that contacts the ash from the landfill so it does not build the head pressure and go into the environment. That design factor is also something that's taken into consideration when we're looking at designing and permitting a facility. Next, we look at the operation of the facility. The proposal that we've put forward, for instance, for the King plant, includes groundwater monitoring system, which will allow us for early detection of any leaks that may occur. Taking all these factors into consideration, I think we've demonstrated that at least the facility that we're proposing is next to West Lakeland Township does provide safe and an adequate disposal facility for Xcel Energy's fly ash, even though it may not meet the criteria for this bill. The impact of this bill is potentially widespread. Had this bill been enforced previously, we believe currently that Xcel Energy would not have been able to site the Wilmer Fast Disposal Facility in Goodhue or in Lewis County, the Red Wing Fast Disposal Facility in Goodhue County, the current Moser Fast Disposal Facility in Washington County, the Sherco Ponds 1, 2, and 3 in Sherburne County, the Sherco Dry Ash Disposal Facility also in Sherburne County, all of which have been operating successfully. Further, we also believe there are other facilities within the state that would not have been able to be permitted, specifically the Becker RDF Ash Disposal Facility in Anoka-Champlain, also in Sherburne County, the Bonco 2 Demolition Landfill, the Burnsville MSW Landfill, the FKB Industrial Landfill, and the Elk River MSW Landfill. It is inevitable that we will have to have, we've not been permitting a lot of new landfills lately, it is inevitable that we will need to build new landfills or expanded landfills in the future. It's not a sure thing that these new facilities will just be able to be expanded on the existing footprint and may in fact need a new solid waste permit. This bill could very well make these initiatives extraordinarily expensive. Finally, we are concerned with the cost that this bill, we are concerned that this bill will add cost disposal of our fly ash while providing really no tangible benefit to the environment. If we are not permitted to open an existing landfill, then we will have to evaluate our options. The draft environmental impact statement that was prepared for this facility has identified some options. The two existing landfills that are proposed are also, as we believe, in highly sensitive areas. In this case, it's our understanding that if we were to move to those facilities, it would add millions of dollars of extra costs to our customers with no tangible or appreciable improvements to the environmental protection. We do believe that the landfills that we construct and operate do demonstrate and set a standard for the way that this kind of waste should be managed. We do believe that that the way we operate these facilities does provide the greatest protection, and we do not believe this legislation, as proposed, will add to the safety of the disposal of the fly ash. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Clark, has there been, to your knowledge, any contamination or complaints against Xcel for contamination or believed contamination at any of your disposal sites that you currently operate?
Madam Chair, Representative, how are you characterizing it with respect to the TC or the existing areas that the representative was discussing?
Any landfills that you currently operate for disposal of fly ash?
I don't think there's been complaints, but Chuck Sponsor, if the chair or the committee allows, I would like to call Chuck Sponsor to help me out with this question. He's our hydrogeologist for our facility.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chuck Donkers. I'm a geologist with Xcel. I've been a geologist for 25 years here. My responsibility is monitoring the landfills that Xcel runs for ash disposal in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Colorado. We do have documented the existing Moser pit, which is in Oak Park Heights, does have groundwater impact. However, the groundwater impacts are attributed to old operations when the facility was online. The initial landfill was opened up in the early 70s, and again, it was just dumped into the pit, no liner. The new phases of the landfill has now gone to a synthetically lined, composite line system, and those areas are not attributed to causing any impact. In fact, as a part of our remediation, we capped the old phases of the molter pit. And what we've seen from that capping operation, just put, basically putting an umbrella over the landfill, we have cut off infiltration, and we've seen so far a 60% decrease in the downgrading plume. And we anticipate that plume to go back to leak background conditions by cutting off leakage generation. So we do have impact, but it's attributed to the old portions and not due to the current design that we're proposing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, could you remind me your name, sir?
Dr. Dockers.
Mr. Dockers. How long has this current technology been in place? You know, you line the facilities, you cap them eventually. How long has this been, have you been doing this with fly ash for?
We started the late 80s. 1988, 89 is when we constructed our first line facilities with a synthetic clay composite. So we have about approximately a 20-year history with this new design.
Madam Chair, so how do we know? I mean, we know that we all kind of screwed up before, that we've allowed this to happen, that, you know, that we've created groundwater contamination from disposal fly ash, but now we have a new kind of plastic envelope system that you put these things in there. We're still talking less than 20 years, though, right? So, you know, being somewhat concerned about our children and our children's children, I mean, do we have any indication that these plastic liners aren't going to leak in 25 years and 30 years? I mean, how do we know that? And if we don't, then what's the other precautions that we might have in place to assure that, you know, okay, say this plastic liner fails in some way, how do we protect against that? Those are two questions. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative, correct. We have 20 years. We have two aspects in our that we use to give us assurances. Number one, that the site is deemed to be monitorable, both the existing as well as the proposed. And it's been the conclusion of the state and other hydrologists that it is a monitorable site, which is critical. It allows us to pick up a release if it were to occur. Okay. And then the second aspect is demonstrated by our existing molter pit, is that if a release does occur, if there is a failure of some sort, we've demonstrated that the capping, just the surface capping alone, can correct the issue by cutting off the leakage or cutting off infiltration, eliminating water building up inside the landfill, and so if you're not adding water to your coffee pot, you're not going to get coffee into the premise. And that cap is always accessible. We can always go back and improve the cap, rebuild the cap. So there is assurances in that regard. And as long as we have post-closure monitoring, you can confirm the landfill is operating as designed.
So by capping the top, and you said you've been able to reduce the leachate by 60% from the existing, but there still is some plume seepage from the pit that was done incorrectly in the 70s. But you said that you've been able to reduce that 60%. You're telling us now that we'll be able to reduce it 100% in these new landfills, correct?
Correct. Madam Chair, Representative, we believe we've cut off leachate infiltration of water. What we've seen is a 60% decrease in the concentration over the past 5 years. However, in order to get 100% recovery, we have to wait for that entire landfill capacity to drain, which takes time, years, as well as the time for that contaminant to hit the groundwater and make it to our monitoring system. And at the molter pit, groundwater is moving between 50 and 150 feet per year, so it just takes time. And it doesn't move as a slug. So what we're seeing is that the gradual, you know, we've shut off the faucet, we're now waiting for the plume to kind of pass. we're not seeing additional contribution. We're just waiting for the existing material to flush itself.
One last question, Matt. So back to the test that's being proposed then for landfill siting. Wouldn't you argue then that if there is some leakage and we're trying to, we can mitigate 60% of that leakage or limit by capping it or maybe more, by putting these landfills on sites that wouldn't allow for the seepage from down below at all? I mean, wouldn't that prevent even that amount of leakage that's happening from happening? I mean, the neighbors around there want 100%. You know, they don't want any. So 60% reduction, now that's probably, if I was living next to them and my kids were playing there and drinking the water or whatever, I mean, I wouldn't want any. So having a test that allowed us to site these only on places that isn't going to allow for any seepage at all, doesn't that seem to be a nice precaution for the neighborhood?
Madam Chair, Representative, there's more than one siting criteria that are used when we're trying to site a landfill, one of which is the susceptibility of the groundwater to contamination. There are other features. The monitorability is an example of something that we think is important for the development of a new site. In some cases, the characteristics that make a site highly monitorable and improve our ability to respond to a potential release are the same characteristics that lend a site to be highly sensitive. So, and there's other criteria as well that have to happen. And so when we site a landfill, we're not just looking exclusively at one set of criteria, but an aggregation of several criteria. One of which, and an important one of which, is that sensitivity to the groundwater. So, to answer your question specifically, it would depend on the site.
It just seems to me that sensitivity to groundwater contamination is a pretty important determinant. You know,
it is.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question I've got is for Mr. Clark. I've got two questions. One is, how much time do we have before we can no longer use the Molter pit and we have to have another landfill? And the second question is regarding the SKB site. I thought I heard you say that if this bill were in place, that site would not be able to operate the way it is. And I visited that SKB site, and I think the triple liner looks like a good plan for the future as far as landfills. And I don't know how many years those are guaranteed for. So I've got that question as well as how much time do we have.
Madam Chair, Representative, with respect to the first question, the Molter's facility is expected to run out of capacity in the year 2010. That's based upon the assumption that with the new systems in place, we're generating ash at the 80,000 tons per year. With respect to the second question, what I tried to characterize is the existing SKB site, as we understand it, is currently sited in an area that would be deemed as highly sensitive. Under the current proposal, as we understand it, we would be able to take it to an existing cell there. The question is that with the additional costs that are there, if we can build a comparable facility that has the protection that's necessary, why move from one highly sensitive area to another? And specifically, the third aspect of the question would be, I don't know how long the capability of that site is, but that's one of the criteria that has to be considered when you're looking at establishing this kind of criterion. I know that some of the sites that we have are limited, and an expansion may not necessarily be on the same footprint. Consequently, our existing facilities, one of the options may be to build a new site, which would be in the vicinity of the current plant, would be in a highly sensitive area and would be precluded from being constructed on this proposal. I don't know if that's the situation at SKB.
And I was just looking for an answer to the question of how long would a triple line site like either at SKB or at the sites you're looking at in Lake Elmo or wherever it is, Oak Park Heights, Lakeland, I think. How long is that expected to last, given current knowledge of the technology?
I don't know that we have any more information than we do for the current landfill design. It has the same basic elements as you've indicated. As you suggested, that they have more series of liners in some of their cells, so they do have a more varied waste stream. But generally the same materials, so I'm afraid I don't have any information on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get a handle on just volume here. So how much in a boxcar coal, how much fly ash is created from a boxcar coal? Or some other thing that we can get a handle on. And if you're looking at what's left after you burn a certain volume of coal.
Madam Chair, Representative, if you're speaking to the kink panel, and I don't know the exact number, but it depends in large about the types of combustion technology that you're using and the type of fuel. Generally speaking, ash is the non-combustible residue from the combustion of coal. Obviously, would like to get the most energy as possible out of the coal, and so our objective is to reduce the volume. If you have a typical facility without scrubbers, it may be somewhere between 10 and 15%. If you add a scrubber, such as has happened at the King plant, you could essentially double the amount of ash that is generated. It's important to note that when you double the ash, it's through the addition of lime or limestone that causes the additional volume.
I think I have one last question for you. One of the things that has been hard to understand in this testimony is that sometimes folks take the scrubber ash and mix it with the stuff from the scrubber and mix it in to put in a landfill, and sometimes they manage that as hazardously. Which are you intending to do with this?
Madam Chair, Representative, our intent at this point is to combine the fly ash with the scrubber residues.
And if the scrubber residues were analyzed on their own, would they be a hazardous waste?
Madam Chair, Representative, I've not tested them, but the primary constituents would be limestone, and then whatever we're taking from the stack, which would be sulfur dioxide.
I'm talking about the stuff from the stack. If it was tested on its own, would it be a hazardous waste?
I've not tested those.
I think that's a critical issue. All right, thank you for testifying. We appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
And are there others in the audience that would like to testify? I think you got it. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Ketchum, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Waste Management. And with me is Terry Johnson. He's the Director of Groundwater Protection for Waste Management in the Midwest region. We're here today on behalf of Waste Management, but we're also representing the National Solid Waste Management Association. This legislation is very broad. It's come up very quickly. It has impact beyond our organization. I think there are parties out there that haven't really participated or haven't weighed in here because of how quickly this has come up. There currently are 21 landfills in the state for solid waste purposes. Waste Management has three of those facilities. There are two other private facilities. The remainder of the facilities are publicly owned facilities. The counties, several counties in the state have solid waste landfills that they use to provide for land disposal purposes, and those facilities would also be affected by this legislation. despite Representative Bond's focus on Lakeland Township and the XL site, again, this legislation is very broad. It affects a multitude of land disposal sites. And I wanted to note that we fully appreciate the change in the language allowing for expansions not to be affected. However, our concern is that this legislation is precedent setting. It establishes a scientific process, testing, and an environmental review process by the PCA that really will be, we have concerns that it would be demanded at expansions, regardless of whether this legislation exempts those facilities. So we're here on behalf of Waste Management and NSWMA to testify to those specific concerns. I think the objective with this language is to establish a second level of review. The objective is to provide for another test, another environmental review process to further ensure that whatever site is selected is going to be even more protective of the environment. And our question is, does this legislation really do that? Does this test really provide a second layer of protection that you're seeking? So the question is this the right test? And with that, is this a useful test? Or the costs incurred for this type of test, are they warranted, or is it money that there's no additional environmental benefit gained? In the last hearing on this, a quote of $175 was given for the test, and right now we don't even know if there's a lab in Minnesota that can do the test. We're checking on that, and we're not sure whether the quote of $175 was for each well, is it for one sample? Does this mean we'll have to put in additional wells at our existing sites or additional wells at a new site? Each well costs somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. And you're also talking about costs for the state agency. And even though you know, they, in their fiscal note, have identified a minimal level of cost, we do believe it will be more, given the nature that the PCA has a broader authority to require additional testing that's not specified in the legislation. So it will generate additional controversy, questions about whether any test required by PCA is adequate or actually provides the technical knowledge needed to make that assessment.
If you could hold for a minute, Representative Angel has a question, Representative Moe has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the testimony. However, does your company contract with Excel to haul fly ash to the landfills throughout the state?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, we don't have a contract with Excel. They have their own, they call them captive sites. So that is the new site that they're proposing is a captive site. It's their own company-owned landfill, and they manage their own ash. Waste Management does not trust their ash.
Thank you.
Representative Small.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I need to go back to towards the beginning of your testimony. You said that Waste Management isn't necessarily against this bill, but that a proposed possible expansion of this bill or other legislation that might be inspired by this bill. It seems the camel's nose under the tent argument that we hear quite often, which I question. But and then follow-up question then is, if in fact this inspires some other piece of legislation that would affect you, you're then concerned about having to dig wells to actually test the groundwater at those sites that you might have if in fact another bill came forward that did something like this bill, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, just to clarify my earlier statement, our concern is that this will become state policy, and TCA has broad latitude with this piece of legislation. If we're in a siting process with an expansion, opponents to that expansion can then point to this piece of legislation and say, okay, we want these tests. We require these tests despite the fact that this legislation exempts an expansion. On the additional wells, just generally, the question will be, in order to test for tritium and to perform these additional tests, the question is, will we have to put in additional wells? And I wanted you to know what the cost of additional well placement is, which is somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 per well. So since it's, I wanted you to know what the cost is.
Madam Chair, just a point of information. I mean, my understanding of the amendment does not require expansion of existing landfills to meet this requirement. Am I right here in the amendment?
I think we're going to have to, we're watching our time, so if we could be as
at this point as possible now. At this point, I'd like to turn to our technical expert, Terry Johnson, and he's going to explain a little bit about his background and then questions that we have about using tritium as an indicator for groundwater sensitivity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Terry Johnson. I'm a professional geologist in Minnesota. I've got about 20 years of experience in hydrogeology. And as Julie mentioned, I cover the upper Midwest, about five states in the upper Midwest, and a couple provinces within Canada involving about 40 landfill facilities for the company. I took a look at this proposed bill yesterday and basically looked at a technical review of what was proposed, not focusing as much on some of the policy implications. And I guess in summary, was left with a number of questions. First of all, myself and a colleague that assisted me in the review were not able to really figure out what background concentrations are in with tritium as they are distributed across Minnesota. And that really is a key consideration whenever you're going to apply a criteria across the state, is to understand what the actual background distribution is in precipitation. It does vary across the upper Midwest from perhaps 10 tritium units to as low as 3. If the background in portions of the state is indeed 3 or less than 5, that would render the criteria unsuitable for its intended purpose. Perhaps there's documentation to this effect out there, but we were not able to obtain it. Also, as has been discussed earlier, tritium groundwater is often a combination of shallow groundwater due to infiltration of surface water, which would be representative of background tritium levels, which then mixes with deeper water in areas where deeper groundwater is discharging, which again would reduce the tritium count in the groundwater to below 5 in many cases, and again making this criteria not suitable for its intended purpose. And there are a number of hydrogeologic scenarios in which mixing lateral flow, slow migration through low permeability units where older signatures of tritium during thermonuclear testing would be present, which would indicate even though a site had time of travel greater than 20 years at the site is unsuitable with this criteria. So we have a number of questions as to exactly how this would be applied, how it would work. There seems to be a lot of questions for a criteria of this nature. And typically, we would go through a peer review process if you were, for instance, publishing a paper on the science of this, and we have not had that opportunity in this legislation. So other questions that were identified is the definition of an aquifer is we could tell in Minnesota is very vague. It simply indicates a formation that will transmit water to a well. That could be applied in a real aquifer that would be supplying water for domestic purposes. It could also be applied in shallow groundwater wells that would not meet other definitions of an aquifer. I think the vagueness of the aquifer definition would open up opportunities for abuse of this criteria and applying it inappropriately. And so I think in summary, we're left with a number of questions as to whether or not this criteria will even work as intended or work reliably. The tritium, after all, has a half-life of 12.3 years, so tritium levels are decreasing continuously in the atmosphere and in groundwater. So it's not a stable, a set criteria. And why, you know, the 20-year criteria seems somewhat arbitrary. There was no background as to why 20-year time of travel is more important than 25 or 10 or 30. And then lastly, you know, land disposal facilities are certainly not the only potential source of groundwater contamination in Minnesota. There's many other areas, and why is this applying singularly to these systems when we have gas station sites, group or mounded septic systems for community subdivisions that are also potential sources. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we have gone over your time, I think. Unless there's a pressing question, I suspect these witnesses will be there after session and will be available to ask questions. No pressing questions. Thank you all so much for coming.
I just want, Madam Chair, I just wanted to note that the document that we've passed out is we put together very late last night, and we are in the process of putting that in the form of a memo, so it'll be a formal document for the committee.
Thank you very much. Representative Bunches, we don't have, if you would just like a one or two sentence wrap up, we don't have the bill physically in our possession yet, just the way things are being processed now.
Madam Chair, I know you have to move on. We will do a written response as well to their written comments since we need to move on. I did have some response to the previous testifier as well, but I'll also put them in writing for the committee. But just want to say, in the scoping document for this particular site, no site that was not high sensitivity was looked at, either hypothetically out of Minnesota or in the surrounding area or in Minnesota. There's also issues if you look at the comments on the DEIS. Once a landfill like this is capped with a liner, some of the geological consulting firms raised issues about that actually making it potentially worse with water actually rising because it now has a liner underneath and creating more leachate in the longer run. So there's many unanswered questions about the what groundwater modeling and the technology of these systems and how it is play out in the much longer run. But thank you for your time today, and we'll do some more written information for you.
Thank you so much. The next bill we have up has is House File 863. I will move that for consideration. This is a bill that has been through many committees, and so I think it's been through many policy committees, so I hope this is a very short policy so people are well grounded in the issue, and then if you would talk about the finances, because there is a fiscal note here, and that we do have to, that's what we will have to be considering.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 863 is an air emissions standard for cars, and the proposal is that we adopt a air emission plan for cars that's more stringent than that under federal law right now. And under federal law, we only have two choices. We can choose the California standards or the federal standards. And the California standard has the benefit of also regulating greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles. One of the big benefits for us and for the consumers in Minnesota if we adopt this legislation is we will save money. Consumers will save money on gasoline because cars that emit less carbon dioxide are also less fuel consuming. Madam Chair, there is an amendment in your packet, I believe it's the AO8-1435, And what we've done is we've drafted this amendment in response to some of the concerns that have been raised in other committees. Other policy concerns people have raised are concerning the fuel standards in California, which we are not adopting, the leaf blower standards in California, which we are not adopting. And this amendment makes clear we're not adopting other portions of California law. It also addresses a concern raised by the Street Rod Association about street rods and collector vehicles to make absolutely clear that since this legislation can only affect model years 2012 and later, they are clearly not affected by this legislation, and so 168.10 is exempted from the legislation.
I'd like to move the AO 81435 amendment.
Senator Hansen has moved 1435. Members, you heard the explanation. I see no questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted.
And Mr. Chair, and I would like to thank the author for bringing forward this amendment. I've heard from a lot of street rodders, and I really appreciate that you took their concerns into account.
Thank you, Representative Dalsey. Representative Portman.
Madam Chair, I thank you, Representative Scalzi. I think they had valid concerns and they were easily addressed, and so I was happy to do it. With regard to the fiscal note, members, my understanding is the fiscal note in the first year is $134,000. I think it's very important for Minnesota to incur this expense to undertake this program and put this legislation into place. And the reason why is when we set the Next Generation Energy Act goals last year, if we weren't serious about it, we never should have adopted those goals. This is a step we can take to start to get us towards meeting those goals that actually save consumers money over the long term. My understanding is that the governor's Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group came up with a calculation of a net savings to Minnesotans of $239 million from this measure between now and 2025. So I think $134,000 is a price that's well worth paying for a benefit of $239 million to the state. Just to give you an idea of the scale of the policy, this would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 13.1 million metric tons by 2025. The entire state total that we're projected to have in 2025 is 184.5 million metric tons. So it's really a substantial reduction that we're talking about. Madam Chair, with that, I think Jim Urkel from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and I are willing to take any questions you might have.
Okay, and I see the two amendments have been passed out, but I doubt that you have received either one of them, so I would like it if you would see these amendments and have a moment to look at them. Well, apparently, I have one. I understand that there's the second one coming.
I'm going to have a look at that now.
Yes, please.
Madam Chair? Madam Chair, I see we're past our time, but what's your intention with the bill? Are you intending to meet later today?
We are meeting later today, but we are going to finish up this bill this morning.
Well, Madam Chair, what time are we meeting later today?
I believe it's been posted at 4 o'clock. We will finish up this one right now. This is actually a fiscal committee, and the first question I will have are these fiscal amendments or these policy amendments.
Well, Madam Chair, I have another committee meeting that's previous, it's a regular scheduled meeting at 4 o'clock. And I've got significant questions about the bill. I have not served on a committee that's heard this bill before. So this is my only opportunity, Madam Chair, to do this.
You have the opportunity right now.
We're past our allotted time, Madam Chair, too.
The committee has been posted for quite a while that we would be operating this way. Representative Bill, I see that A8 is your amendment. Would you like to tell us what it is, and it's just a fiscal amendment?
It is not. I'd like to move the A8 amendment. This is the second time that I've been able to hear the bill. the first time the author told us that there really, as I recall, there was no intention to include all-terrain vehicles and these things that are mentioned in here. And this language, as I understand it, is in the over in the Senate as well. This is exact language. I think it's exact language. It was in the Senate side. And so without explaining any further, I think it's pretty obvious what it does.
Madam Chair, if the author of the amendment would be willing to accept this small oral addition, I would be willing to accept this as a friendly amendment. In line 1.3, where it says, if the California emission standards, if we add the words referred to in this section are extended to off-road vehicles or engines, blah, 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 then we opt out. If we add the words referred to in this section after standards, I would consider this a friendly amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not an attorney like Representative Hortman, so I'll accept that. And I hope that it doesn't. I hope that it doesn't do anything unintended. Again, it's you know, I'm not. I just don't have the ability in this short a time period to accept to understand the implication of it. But I'll come back and take it out if I find out that it's doing something I don't want it to do. We'll have a food fight over it.
I don't think this is food fight material. You are. There can be many, many California emission standards, and I think the ones you're talking about are these.
Right. Yeah, I think we're okay, but I just want to make sure that the food fight will happen if it does unintended consequences, and I can figure it out.
Representative Dill has moved A8 with the, and he has accepted incorporating an amendment that says refers to in this section after standards. I think we have to adopt the refers to in this section first. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. The amendment is before you, members. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is adopted. There is another amendment, and that's the A9 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the A9 amendment. And this amendment may not be as non-controversial as the first one. This would say that the Section 1 is not adopted until air attainment in each of the air attainment areas has exceeded federal and national ambient standards at any point in time and has been designated as an area by the EPA. And there are 9, as I understand it, there are 9 attainment areas in the state. And from time to time, they exceed. But there are some areas that don't exceed. And they're generally the rural areas. And my original intention was to say that the 7 county metro would get the brunt of this bill and not the rural areas. That you represent Moe's area, my area, Anzell's, and others across the state, but apparently we can't do that under the federal law. So what I'm saying is this won't kick in. This section will not kick in until all of the attainment areas have exceeded the air attainment quality standards at least once.
Representative Hill, just as a question here, the federal ambient air quality standards have to do with which pollutants? Which pollutants are you looking at here?
That's a good question. I don't know all of them, but carbon dioxide, CO2.
I don't believe CO2 or carbon dioxide are part of the federal national ambient air quality standards, so I think...
And then also particulate matter, the same things that happen. For example, this... you got the asthma alerts and what have you in the Twin Cities. Those types of we don't have those out in the rural areas, but yet we're going to be forced to buy automobiles that are compliant with California standards out in the rural areas, and we don't need it.
I think we're talking about two different pollutants here, two different categories of pollutants. Representative Portman,
Madam Chair, members, I would encourage a no vote on this amendment.
The federal law that allows us to opt into California standards requires that we have non-attainment at some point in Minnesota. Representative Dill would take that one step further and say we have to have non-attainment more broadly statewide. And the fact that we have non-attainment in the metro area and have had non-attainment is what makes us eligible to opt in. Iowa, for example, their air isn't bad enough. They can't choose the California standards until their air gets worse, which they're expected to have happen this year. So, members, I would urge rejection of this amendment because it also changes what we're doing and makes it impermissible under the federal law. Okay.
Members, is there a question? Representative Magna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm trying to understand the how this the bill, actually, House File 863, how does that affect Section A here when it says the adoption of standards? And my question is what I think Representative Dill is trying to do is that my understanding here that we have several different areas of the state that that the Pollution Control Agency is supposed to look at, and it's supposed to take into consideration such factors, it says on line 1.18 and line 1.19, such factors at which it may deem proper is existing physical conditions, zoning classifications, topography, prevailing wind and velocities, and so on. And I'm wondering how the amendment affects that section. And I mean the bill, number one, affects it, and then number two, how Representative Dill's amendment affects it.
Representative Portman.
Madam Chair, Representative Magnus, under federal law with regard to motor vehicle air emissions, we have two choices and two choices only. We can go with the rules that have been drafted by the EPA, or if we have had non-attainment, we can opt into the California standards, which are more stringent. Under federal law, we don't have the option of adopting Representative Dill's amendment and putting further constraints on when or if we're going to apply these standards. We either opt in or opt out.
Well,
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm trying to figure this out because I'm not sure if your bill, in effect, should have deleted Section A with what you're doing. And I'm also trying to figure out the part here where it says on line 2.7 to 2.9 must be identical to the vehicle regulations adopted by the California Air Resources Board. Now, my question is, what are those folks out in California going to adopt?
Representative Portman.
Madam Chair, Representative Magnus, the First Amendment we adopted referred specifically to the sections of the California regulations that we're adopting under Title 13, Section 1900, Section 1961 and Section 1961.1, and I can print those out and bring those to you so we know exactly what we're adopting.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'd appreciate that because I'd like to know exactly what we're doing, and I'm concerned then, or my concern then about what they're going to do in the future. Your Amendment 1435 takes that concerns away. Then is that a fair correct assessment? I mean, I'm worried about what the folks out in California are going to do in the future if we're tied to that. Because as I read that line, 2.7, 2.8, and 9, it says must be identical, must be incorporated to the regulations adopted by California Air Emissions Board.
Representative Portman.
Madam Chair, Representative Magnus, if those standards are updated, we are opting into their updates. And I'm very specifically urging us to do that because we have a choice to innovate as Governor Schwarzenegger has in California, or we have a choice to innovate as the federal government has in Washington, D.C. I think all of us who watch the federal government in Washington, D.C. are clearly aware of how many decades it takes to do something that could take a matter of 3 or 4 years. And so we are making a clear choice to innovate more rapidly.
Madam Chair, so just to be clear, your bill then is going to tie us, we're tying the hands of our state, we're just going to follow along whatever the folks out in California do. How many people make up this air Resources Board. I mean, I don't know the background of this outfit. I don't know if they're... I don't want to abdicate Minnesota's abilities to take care of ourselves to California. I lived in Minnesota. I don't live in California.
Representative Magnus, I think you've made your point, but Representative Portman, would you like to respond?
I don't need to. I think it might be helpful if it was Nebraska, say, or Wisconsin, but the choices we have under federal law is that the EPA, Stephen Johnson, and his entire staff make the rules for our state, or the California Air Resources Board makes the rules for our state with regard to motor vehicle emissions.
Well, Madam Chair, we elect the folks in the United States, in the U.S., and they appoint people to administer and direct these agencies. We don't elect anybody in California. I'm very concerned that we're tying we're basically abdicating our responsibilities to take care of ourselves here to whatever the folks in California think we ought to be doing. Well, maybe we've got enough activists around here from California or funded by all these California groups. Maybe they ought to move back to California.
That was it.
Well, back to the amendment, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Moe is the next. And then we'll move your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Portman, maybe I'm confused here. Isn't there an opt-out clause in here the legislature can opt out in? And I haven't read the bill since we heard it last week, but am I mistaken on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, we can opt out anytime we want. And our federal representatives in Washington, D.C. drafted this choice for us, I believe, in 1975.
Thank you. Representative Steele, do you want to make one last comment and move your amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, actually, I think I moved the amendment.
Well, I mean,
take a vote.
We've been a vote.
Okay. You said something, Representative Portman, that intrigued me. You said that we are out of attainment, and so therefore, in I don't remember exactly what you said, but we need this. Well, you must have a mouse in your pocket, because I look at the attainment areas, and there's a whole lot of attainment areas that aren't out of attainment, a whole bunch of them. And so my first thought was I wanted to narrow this down to you folks that have got your air so dirty. And I look around here and think to myself, how many people in this room right now, in fact, how many people in the legislature of the 201 members today took public transportation to get here? I'd like to see someone raise their hand that did that. In fact, Representative Knuth told me that she, and another time I asked her this very question, she said, well, I would like to take public transportation, but I have to change the bus twice, and it takes too long. So, I mean, get up earlier and go to work earlier and leave later and get home later if we're really interested in cleaning up the air. And it's not in Grand Marais or Ely or down in Slayton or up in Twin Valley or places like that that need this California emissions. It's places right here where this building is and around this area, and that's what this amendment is about.
Representative Portman, would you like one last response?
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, it's my understanding that the air quality around Lake Mille Lacs was out of attainment within the last 2 years. We knew we were going to debate air attainment standards. We brought somebody from the PCA, but air quality is an issue all over the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. I see no other questions. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No. Amendment fails. I don't see any other amendments.
Madam Chairman, division on that.
Division? Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, raise their hand. All those opposed? We're 6 in favor, 10 opposed.
I have had
to copy this. Which is important. Thank you, it's important. Members, we have gone past your time. We've talked about the fiscal thing. If there's any final wrap-up thing you want to say, I'm going to lay this on the table for possible inclusion. No final thing. This is, we are not adjourning. We are in recess now until 4 o'clock. We will reconvene, and I don't see Representative Moe, who's first on the agenda here, so we will take Representative Barger. As with all of these bills, we are going to lay them on the table with possible inclusion in the honor of this bill, and or they will go out of this committee on next Tuesday. One of the things I didn't announce this morning, and I was hoping there'd be more people here, we have gotten our targets, and the targets are the same as the governor's targets in this biennium, but double that in the next biennium. So we will have a substantial amount of work to do in this committee. With that, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 3238 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. You've moved House File 3238 for possible inclusion. If you would go through it quickly for us, we'd appreciate it.
Certainly. And, Madam Chair, I just wanted to make a quick comment about the fiscal note, which I got yesterday, which is why we had it off the register and then on to finance. I'm just noticing they worked off the first engrossment, not the second engrossment, so some of the fiscal stuff in here will actually not apply anymore. And I had a sick child today, so I wasn't able to get access to this and figure out just what's left, but we can sort that out in the committee. Mm-hmm. Madam Speaker,
as I understand, a new fiscal note has been ordered.
Okay, great.
And we don't have final fiscal notes for a number of things, so not to worry.
Very good. Madam Chair, the issue related to environmental finance has to do with the Section 3 of the bill, which is the Section 2 and 3 relating to a conservation rate structure. As we heard in the drinking water subcommittee, most cities in the metro area and some in greater Minnesota have a conservation rate structure. This is where you might face an increasing block rate for residential water use. The more you use, in the city of Shoreview, we have this where I live in Lionel Lakes and Blaine, where if you use over a certain number of gallons per month or per quarter, the rate goes up. But it also has a lot of flexibility built into it, and I appreciate the technical assistance of the DNR and Met Council on defining conservation rate structure. It doesn't necessarily imply increased rates. It can include peak rates, so if you have a regular business user of water that's very consistent and efficient, a city water supplier might not focus on them, but rather on peak users, such as people using long sprinklers and the like at peak times during the year. This would allow some consistency across public water suppliers throughout the state. And part of the fiscal note has to do just with compliance to make sure that DNR is aware with how these structures are working.
Excuse me, Representative Gardner, can you point that out to us specifically, that part?
About the conservation rate structure, Madam Chair?
This is the fiscal note that says 80,000, is that it?
Just give me a moment here. The PC stuff is out.
Well, we can as the fiscal note is redone, we can ask why this has a cost to it. It's not intuitive to me.
Very good. I see under DNR there would it be at 0.25 FTEs in order to collect, review, and compile data, although they actually do compile rate data currently.
Would DNR like to respond to that?
think the 0.25 is the only one that should be remaining, I think.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Zapp, Circuit Director, DNR Division of Water. The bill requires that the public water suppliers implement conservation rate structures by a certain date and submit that to the department as proof. So we would have to go through some sort of review process and looking at those to assure that they met the criteria for the rate structure. So that's what that 0.25 FTE is. And we would absorb that cost. We're looking at several different ways of doing that. One, requesting with the annual water use report or doing a special mailing so that we get that information as cheap as possible.
Okay, so you would absorb the cost, you're saying, so the next fiscal note on that portion will show up as nothing?
Correct.
Okay, that's important to know. Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair, I do see in the out years the two different additional FTEs required in 09, 10, 11, and 12. Those had to do with the emergency water plan, which are no longer part of the bill. So.
Thank you. Representative Gardner, please continue.
Madam Chair, I could beat you to death with all of the details of the bill, but the first section I think is the most interesting. It just lays out why water resources conservation program which exists in the state, and that is the focus which flashed out best interest to the people and been more specific to say that this has to do with sustainability of the resource. That would actually be a big philosophical step for us. And the issue of groundwater information standard and sharing data on groundwater information. Every party that I've talked to has appreciated that, knowing that they could get the raw data on groundwater information in the same format. And the final part of this is the advisory committee for the Metropolitan Council and their water supply advisory committee, which has actually been doing good work. I've sat in on a couple of the meetings, and they still have some work to do. It gives me some assurance that there are people working on this issue so that we don't have an Atlanta-like situation where we're wondering where our water's coming from. And that's it, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, members. Are there questions for members on this? Okay, I think we resolved the fiscal note issue, and so we will lay this over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative Moe, you're up next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another hearing, so let me sweat myself a little bit.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3437, and because it has a fiscal cost, we need to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is the Star Lakes bill. It's been through a few stops. I think everybody here has seen it before. If you haven't, I will give a brief overview, but we'll talk about the fiscal part of the bill. This is a program that will be encourage citizen involvement, lakeshore associations to become actively involved in the management, developing a management plan for their lake or river, using existing state resources, and after they have established a management plan and made significant headway on that management plan, then they are going to be designated a Star Lake or a Star River. That will be a benefit to them for real estate purposes, for tourism purposes. Bud Lake in Fairmont could be a Star Lake, and Representative Gunther will be able to talk about that here in the legislature. We also have amended the bill since it was in policy. Some members had concern about the nonprofit citizen commission we were establishing. Thought it would make more sense that an existing state agency would have oversight with designating Star Lakes. In particular, there might be some consulting role there that it makes more sense to use our current state agencies as opposed to bringing a new or establishing a new entity that might be problematic in some ways. So we asked Bowser to take this on, and we amended the bill to require Bowser to establish and the positions and also a citizens committee to make recommendations to them. They've given us a fiscal note, and if the committee would like, I see two staffers from Bowser here. I don't know which one of you is interested in. All right. Mr. Jaffe will come up and explain the fiscal cost of this and what their recommendations are.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. John Jaskey, Executive Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources, and Julie Clocker, our Assistant Director, was also involved in preparing the fiscal information. I don't know if there's been a fiscal note that you have before you, Madam Chair and members. If you don't, if we have an unofficial one, I could have passed on.
We do not have one. We have it only as questions.
And this is basically a copy of an email message I sent to Representative Mo saying this is what we had prepared, you know, for doing on many of these at the last minute. But this is a fairly, I think, complete summary from our agency's perspective. And as Representative Mo noted, the amendment that was made in a part of committee basically took the responsibility and put it under our agency from what was originally set up as an independent Star Lake nonprofit board, I guess is the best way to describe it. On the one hand, that certainly puts it under an existing format that's known and understood. On the other hand, it basically puts the state in a position of having to accomplish this with the staff resources that would be needed, and we've identified what we think are three full-time equivalents needed to carry this out, and we're basing that on a couple of things. One, that we would need to have one person responsible for this program. We're making some gross estimates here that there's, let's say there's 10,000 lakes and 1,000 lake associations. We know there are 800 of them that have identified themselves as members of Minnesota Waters, and we know there's several more beyond that that are in existence already. And we're estimating that 50 of them in a given year would want to pursue Star Lake designation. So that's our starting point. And so we need someone that would be responsible for making the decisions to provide that designation or not. The other thing that we would feel obligated to do is to respond to requests for help in developing what's called a comprehensive lake or river management plan. One could say we could be asked and we could say no, we will not help, but when government is involved, it's hard for us to say no, we can't, because our model has been that when we review and approve local water management plans of various organizations, we have a responsibility to help them be ready for that approval process to occur. And so we would envision something like that being necessary under this legislation as well. And so with that, I will conclude and stand for any questions or comments.
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Madam Chair, Bowser has done exactly what I asked him to do, and I appreciate that. I think that discussion should continue as to how best to go forward with this function. I think they're personally, and I do again appreciate the work, but I think they're assuming a greater level of responsibility than I had hoped that they would, and so I think if this becomes part of our omnibus bill, I'd like to get discussions to continue with the chair and Mr. Jaffe as to maybe how we can clarify and perhaps narrow their function a bit here.
We don't have a final fiscal note, and today we are laying over everything anyway. So the other thing I would ask, if you thought about folks who apply
putting some resource into the application process. And I don't see that as in here, did I?
No, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have, I mean, we've considered that, and I don't think that's off the table, but I also, there are foundations, including the Initiative Foundation, who have expressed interest in private money, and that was part of the incentive for having the outside foundation, in that we have potentially, this could be a self-funding program without the state having to create, you know, an additional entity. And so I guess I'd like to continue to have that discussion with you as to how to go about funding. If we can capture private donations because they would like to see the citizen involvement, then we need to make sure we have the mechanism to do that.
The mechanism could be folks who are applying for Star Lake actually get money from the foundation to make the application.
A good idea.
Could be a way.
Yeah.
But this is, in my judgment, a nice draft of a nice proposal. So, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moore, a lot of the lake associations are doing really great work and just fantastic work, grassroots work. What are we actually trying to accomplish by this? I mean, I'm just trying to think the bureaucracy we're creating and the money we're going to spend to do this. Wouldn't it be better for the lake associations to just be doing the good work they are? I'm trying to recognize, I mean, Mr. Jaffke has laid out here $360,000 or more a year, and I'm just thinking of the lake restoration work we could be doing with that money. Why would we want to do that? That's, I guess, my question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative McNamara, it's a good question. I appreciate it. You know, the idea is that there are lake associations, as you know, and perhaps yours is one of them, that is very engaged and involved in doing this. We'd like to do two things. One, to have public recognition of the excellence in some lake associations. So they should be recognized. You should be able to market your property as being on this lake, as a star lake that you'd be selling your property from, or if there's a resort on your lake, it could be advertised as a star lake because of the hard work that the citizens are doing. Also, there are some lake associations which aren't doing such a good job, and this would be a roadmap for them to follow to do perhaps like your lake is doing at largely a relatively inexpensive cost. And I guess I would say that, and again, appreciative of the work that Bowser has done, I think we can do it with perhaps more private donations or less overhead. And this, I mean, I don't want to force an unfunded mandate on Bowser, but I think we can get a little closer to a smaller government input beyond what state programs we have already funded through this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Moore, this is kind of akin to a Star City program. It looks that we're giving people recognition for the work they've done, like the Star City program requires. You have to have all these things in place, then you can have this designation. And I think it's a terrific idea. I think you will energize a lot of lake associations.
Thank you, Representative Duffer. My grandmother, thank you.
Did you learn how to fish on Bud Lake? Is that
I did?
Okay.
Any other questions? Or Representative Ann, please.
Yeah, I have an amendment.
Yes.
Just get it, pass it out. Well, while it's being passed out, Madam Chair and Representative Moe, I did speak with Representative Moe about this prior to the hearing, and I'll let him just tell the committee what he thinks of it, but in this, I propose a new section to the bill entitled Rulemaking Approval Required. under Minnesota Rules Chapter 6280. That's the aquatic plant management rules, which are currently being, I guess, considered and proposed and debated at the department. And at this point, I plan to go into effect in spring of 2009. This amendment will require the commissioner to submit the rule changes to the chairs of the House and Senate committees having jurisdiction over natural resources, and that the commissioner must receive legislative approval for the proposed changes before the rules may be adopted. As we know, there are thousands of lakes, thousands and millions of lake users. It's a big rulemaking undertaking, and I just would like some legislative oversight and know what the author might think of this amendment.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I know we've had some discussion in this committee about rulemaking happening outside of the jurisdiction of the legislature and some concerns about that. So given that, I would accept the amendment as a friendly amendment. I'm guessing there are members of the committee that might have other comments, though, but I would be willing to accept it as a friendly amendment.
Is there someone, this is not for Bowser, this is for DNR. Is there someone here from DNR who would like to speak to this? Mr. Meyer, there is an amendment 1402 that has just been proposed from Representative Peterson, and I'd give you a chance to look at it.
Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The aquatic plant rulemaking process that this would relate to is being undertaken right now. The sonar is done. This is underway. We're hoping to have them promulgated soon. So I guess we would oppose the amendment as it's drafted.
Can you tell us why? I think that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, members, we've been working with the stakeholder groups on that aquatic plant management permitting process. We're getting ready to go to the ALJ. With that, we will have public hearings, extensive public hearings. Having to come back and receive legislative approval will just delay those rules. If this is the intent of this body, I guess we would just come back with legislation to do it rather than go through the rulemaking process, which is a more open process, involves more meetings with the public, working with the administrative law judges. But the rules that we have that we're proposing will be more aggressive on invasive species. Right now, there is a limit on the amount of aquatic plants that an individual landowner may treat. We're proposing to remove that limit for invasives and allow a person to go very aggressively at the invasive species while protecting the aquatic native vegetation in the lake.
And can you tell us anything else that's your intent under these rules?
Madam Chair, members, had I known this amendment was coming up today, I would have had Steve Hirsch here today, who's in charge of our rulemaking process, and I can't get him here in front of the committee at a later date if you want to talk about this further. What we're looking at doing is to restricting a person's ability from the blanket authority that they have right now to 100 feet or 50% of their property. 50% of the property or 100 feet, whichever is greater right now, to, I believe, 50 feet. There is some concerns that we have about the types of treatments that are used, not the whole lake treatments. We're doing some experimentation on that. But just creating or the removal of the aquatic vegetation around the lake, which is the habitat for the fish, the spawning areas, and also the biological interaction in these lakes that take place with the carbon dioxide, oxygen transfer, and also the nutrient uptake. With the phosphorus levels, the runoff that comes in, non-point source pollution on these lakes, the aquatic plants really do provide a beneficial uptake of that phosphorus to avoid massive algae blooms.
I think
We will be hearing your bill again because we will have a fiscal note. You will have worked with Mr. Dashke, and this will be up again if things have worked out on a week from Tuesday, and perhaps at that time we could hear from DNR more about what this, the meaning of this is, because I hear a tension between the folks who are anxious to have more habitat for fish, period, and folks who want a clear view. So I think maybe we need to have a little more input on this. So, but we will have time, and we'll just make time for that.
Great, thanks, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, are we going to vote on this amendment, or what is your...
Did you make a motion for that?
I did not yet. So I guess I'd like to add it today, if that's possible.
You may add it today?
Yeah.
I mean, you may make a motion to
I
add, and we will vote
to,
on it.
Move to add this amendment to new section, rulemaking approval required.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. I agree with you, Madam Chair. It'd be nice to have some additional testimony. I do think, personally, I would like to see, even though I generally agree with you on how we should administer Lakeshore, I'd like the opportunity to hear the DNR's recommendations. That's my inclination, before they become law. So I would ask that the committee support the amendment, but either way, I'm going to carry on with the bill.
It's been a nightmare.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Representative Moy, I didn't hear if you said support it or not support it.
Yes, I do support it.
Okay. Then, thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could ask Representative Peterson, this seems to be like completely, we were discussing Star Lakes, now I think we're discussing habitat degradation, whatever that word is.
Degradation?
Thank you. Can you explain what your amendment, what the goal is of the amendment?
Thank you, Representative McMahon, to the committee. The goal, I guess, is to bring into the public view through our legislative oversight what these rules for, you know, the thousands and thousands of lakes there are. Example from my area was, I guess, a curly leaf pondweed situation in a lake where the desire was to treat the whole lake, but needed to have approval for a certain chemical that 48 states use, and was getting some, resistance from the Department of Natural Resources in a rural prairie lake, and I ended up doing this without legislation eventually to get this lake treated, but it was found that during the time that there had been several dozens, I believe, of lakes in the metropolitan area that were allowed with not a lot of hang-up to use this same chemical, but when it got out a little farther where property value is not as high and maybe lake association isn't as organized as we just talked about, there was many, many years of delay. So if they're going to be making new rules, I would wonder, you know, what they are, what they entail. It's been going on for a number of years, I believe. It's slated to come in next spring, from what I understand. And I think we have such, you know, pressure on our waters and our aquatic management as to what Mr. Meyer attested to, that I think this committee has enough interest in it to see it before it becomes state rule.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Peterson, what will the effect be, like the problems you alluded to, what will the effect of this legislation be on fixing those problems?
Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair and Representative McMahon. I guess the effect would be that if we don't get to see these rules, we can't really affect them. And if we can see them before they go into effect, our people in our districts who are involved with lake associations and the like, who have recommendations that may or may not get picked up by a, quote, stakeholder group and more public meetings, that this might be an appropriate rule for us to have some influence over.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
Just briefly,
in looking at the bill and discussing it, I know you talked about the activities of the Comprehensive Lake or River Management Plan. That is a huge requirement of the lake becoming a Star Lake. This amendment and our aquatic plant rule-making process will help those organizations achieve their certification. You can see the language on 2.19 to 2.16. Talks about increases in native vegetation, in shoreline areas, the prevention, reduction, elimination of aquatic invasive species, and increasing or maintaining a healthy, diverse fishery. This amendment kind of and where goes in the opposite direction of where those comprehensive lake management plans are going. So I just wanted to make sure people understood that. And we look forward to the discussion on Tuesday about our five plans.
Okay, with that, I think we've had enough discussion on that. I'm going to call for a vote on that, knowing that we will have another opportunity to chat about this a week from today. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say aye.
No.
No. Okay. The amendment is adopted. All right. Anything else for us, Representative Mo?
No, Madam Chair. Again, just I think the purview of this committee is the finance of this project. I think most of us have supported this in the past. The question now remains, what's the mechanism ultimately to make it happen? Bowser is one. The way we've had it drafted now, there would be a significant cost to that. I think we need to put our heads together, and if any members have some ideas about how either to reduce that cost or to come up with the resources to fund it this way, we have time between now and the next hearing.
Super. 34 to 37 is laid over. Representative Bill, 3898.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the bill before and your intention is to include this for apparently possible inclusion.
Thank you. This bill has been through several other committees. The first section has to do with a irregularity that occurred at a bidding. Timber bidding in June of 07. The cost on it, just a little more than $34,000, that would come from the where the money that was paid in excess went to. That money went into that fund. And the second piece has to do with the Forest Resources Council. The money would also come from the Forest Management Investment Account to the council to match another $150,000 of private money for them to go ahead with their work in addressing fragmentation and partialization of private forest land, large corporate type owners like Forest Capital or Blandon or someone of that nature. So that is the bill.
That is. Are there questions? Representative Bill, the suggestion was made by someone that the timber sale refund would be appropriately sent to the Plains Committee. Have you considered that?
I have considered it. The date for filing in the claims process for this year was last November 1st, and so that would mean that this logger, the logging company who is an Anzell constituent, would have to wait till 2009 to receive the money if they prevailed. I did talk to Representative Osment, and Representative Osment, we're talking about the refund. You suggested that I continue on this course, and that you want to, why don't you say what you suggested?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was in conversation with Representative Gill, and then I said that because his committee has already had the testimony on it, that it may, if we get some positive action or can keep it going through the process, if there's some, at some time we need to maybe adjust where it's actually being carried, we can do that whenever appropriate. But I didn't see any reason why it shouldn't continue forward in this committee.
The time probably is now to make a decision, because we do have to do a substantial budget cut for this year and for the next biennium. And so I think members understand that that's what's coming before us.
Well, Madam Chair, it's my understanding, and I'm not on the Claims Committee, but if the Claims Committee found that, in fact, this is a correct claim, that the money would come from the very account that I've asked to have it taken from. And secondly, if this is money, let's just put the shoe on the other foot. If you if you filed a tax return, a personal tax return, and you overpaid by $34,000, and you asked for a refund, they'd have to give it to you if it was lawful. And you know, this was incorrectly done. The DNR has fixed their problem. The money is in the account that came in excess of what should have been paid, and that's the reason that I'm going forward with the bill. I know that times are tight, but that doesn't mean that we take somebody's money that was ill-gottenly gained.
I think that is not the issue here. I think the issue is that we are legislators acting as judge and jury, and that the Claims Committee is well set up to do act in that regard. Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering as to what the concern was, so we could address that. I didn't know if it was because it might impact on your targets, and it would be a way of removing it from your targets by cleaning the claims today. I didn't know if that was an issue or not.
I think the issue is one of appropriateness. Does it belong in the Claims Committee to make a determination whether there was a right or wrong, or because that is the role of, it's my understanding, that's been the historical role of the Claims Committee and not of a legislature who is doing policy. If that, do you want to help me out there, Representative Osmond?
Madam Chair, I think that's one of the concerns that I raised early on when we were dealing with this issue, and I think that it is more appropriate in the Claims Committee, but it can be handled either way. For consistency, it probably would be better to go to the Claims. I don't think that there's a problem in doing that, Representative Dill. Even in our time frame that we have right now, I think we can handle it. I can't promise this because I don't know exactly. I don't have control of the overall agenda, but I think we have time to be able to do that.
Well, Madam Chair, and Representative Osmond, we talked to the claims person. My committee administrator did, and they said that it was our impression that any claim to be considered in this year would have had to have been filed prior to November 1st.
And Madam Chair and Representative Dale, I believe that's correct, but I'm not sure as to where this, when it, the issue is actually before the wrong committee. I don't know exactly where that, how that impacts on this particular issue. Wish I had a clear-cut answer for you.
Well, Madam Chair, I just think that we decide here all the time what's right and wrong. And I think I fairly well described the problem, and the department has corroborated the fact that the mistake was made and that the person spent the $34,000 additional dollars. The department has taken action to correct the problem so that in the future it will not happen again by requiring that the documentation for the bidders be in the hands of the department 4 days prior to the beginning of bidding. And so, except that there's some information that I'm not aware of, which I don't think there is, I think that we have the information necessary to know that this was not done properly and that we can decide on our own. But of course, Madam Chair, you are the chair and you will make the final decision. And I'm asking that you consider doing this as a matter of just being right, that it is correct that when someone makes an error that it's recognized. And I don't think it's complicated, and I'm certain, I really have a lot of faith that if it goes to the claims, as Representative Osmond and I have talked about it, that it will be taken care of. But I don't see why that when we have loggers going out of business almost not even daily, hourly, and equipment being repossessed as we speak, that we don't try and get the money back into the hands of the person that it was improperly taken from. And I'm not saying that DNR did it on purpose. That's not what I'm saying. It was just simply a mistake like we all make. So that's my last comment on this.
I don't see any other questions, so we'll lay this over for consideration. Representative Bill, you have House File 3068.
Okay, and move it with the same motion then?
Yes, please.
And this bill has a note on it that from the accounts, the water wreck, the snowmobile, and the all-terrain vehicle has some small 4,000, 3,000, and 3,000, all of which the agency can absorb. We've been through this in a couple other different committees. It makes the temporary licenses for motorcycle, snowmobile, watercraft, ATVs, all 21 days, and that mimics the automobile time that the temporary certificates are valid for. Problem is that when the dealer sends them in, they don't get turned around fast enough. It's nobody's fault. It's just the way it works. And this gives a little more elbow room for them to have a correct permit. It also, an appropriate permit, it also allows that on the temporary permit, in the case of a snowmobile, it allows for a place to indicate whether a trail sticker was purchased with the registration. Because you can purchase a trail sticker on the ELS and pay $15 for it, or you can do it when you register the snowmobile and only pay $10 for it for 3 years. So there was a problem in the field where someone said they paid for a trail sticker. There was no official notation of it, so that they received a fine. Also, the last item in here of significance is that, and actually I believe where the cost is in this, that the agency is going to absorb through the funds, is regarding making all of the registrations on snowmobiles expire on the same date. Right now, three different registrations expire on three different dates. It's confusing. It's caused problems in the field. This streamlines it. Makes sense.
Okay. Are there questions for... other questions? Yes, Representative Dalkey.
Ms. Chair and Representative Bill, I'm just wondering if the reason the DNR maybe is not in favor of this would be their staff now has to do all of it at the same time. Is it better to space these out for staffing purposes? Or maybe I'm putting words in their mouth. I don't know.
Madam Chair, I think the DNR is in favor of this bill.
Oh, all right. I
understand. No, it just has a small cost, Madam Chair, of which they're absorbing in the fund, because I think they have to send out some new forms with some a couple of informational pieces on the forms, and they've said in the note that they can absorb that through the different accounts.
I don't see any other questions, so 3068 will be laid over. Representative Bill, you have House File 3547.
I'm going to go up the front on this.
I think so. That's a good idea.
And Madam Chair, on this bill, House File 3547, which is becoming the omnibus game and fish bill, there's a stack of amendments from the Bright for various different reasons, and we do not have a fiscal note on the bill. It's only a draft. I received it just when I walked in the door. I haven't had time to absorb it or look through it, but I'm really not prepared. However, there is an amendment that the DNR has here. That is being passed out right now, that they will comment on the, I think they're prepared to comment. So if we could adopt the 1439 amendment first, it's the thick one.
Representative Bill, would you first move your bill?
Okay, I'm sorry. 3547, and we for hold over.
For possible inclusion, or
okay.
What we'll do is actually move it out, but okay. We have to account for the dollar.
Correct. And so then with that, I'd like to then move the 1439 amendment, which is multiple pages stapled together, and then Mr. Boggess is coming down to explain the amendment. Mr. Myers here, too. There's a variety of issues in this amendment, so we may have to have different people up to talk about it.
Expensive.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for DNR, and this AO 81439 amendment relates to a deer simplification proposal that the department's been working on. We pulled together a cross-section of deer hunters and landowners in late 2007 and in January of 2008 to look at, kind of comprehensively look at our deer hunting regulations and come up with some recommendations on how we could simplify the regulations, maintain our ability to manage deer, and also maintain good relationships with landowners. I have Lou Cornicelli with me. He's our big game specialist, and we have a couple of handouts that I think are coming around. I'd like to just take a few minutes before we go through the language in the amendment to have Mr. Cornicelli explain a little bit more about the process and the recommendations that the folks came up with. And I'll just mention also that, this process was going on as we were putting our proposed game and fish bill together, so we did not have this language ready at the time the bill was ready to be introduced. We've been in the process of conducting public input meetings around the state that are just concluding, and Mr. Cornicelli can talk a little bit about what we're hearing from the public as we're talking about deer regulation simplification, and it's also been in the press quite a bit, so we're starting to get some feedback on this, and we can share with you what we're hearing. So with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Cornicelli.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lou Cornicelli, Big Game Coordinator for the Minnesota DNR. Back last year, the Commissioner, Mark Holston, had said that we were going to simplify the deer regulations. Over time, our regulations have really changed and gotten pretty complex with licenses and zones and what people can and can't do. So we put together, as Mr. Boggess said, a group of 13 people from what we thought would represent a wide variety of folks, everything from landowners to deer hunters to people who just had expertise in different forms related to deer and deer management. And they came out with some good recommendations that we just started to take to public input, and I'll touch briefly on that. But the recommendations, and I think we should have just a brief executive summary, they were pretty much asked, in a nutshell, to come up with some ideas on how to simplify regulations. We didn't look at things that I didn't, in other words, I didn't say, you really ought to look at this because I get a lot of calls on it. This is stuff that they came up with on their own. There were good recommendations. And the other thing we didn't do is we didn't talk about, and I guess we'll get into costs and stuff like that, we didn't talk about fiscal implications. This was a pure project to look at deer regulations and making them simpler, and that was it. There were four main recommendations that came out of this. One was to consolidate the number of deer hunting licenses that we have. We currently have 8 adult firearm season licenses, not including muzzleloader, archery use, and all the other stuff. 2 of those licenses cross zones and seasons, and then 6 are just good for a firearm zone. So the recommendation was to consolidate the number of licenses, basically to 2 from 8, and compress the state in the recommendation 2, just to have 2 zones. Right now we have 6 firearm zones. We can get by with just 2 and just allow people to hunt in those 2 zones, an A season, which is our standard opener, and then a B season, which is the Southeast 3B. Just greatly simplifying the number of, again, zones and licenses. The third was to simplify the how you tag deer in the state. There was a legislation a couple years ago that mandated folks not their license, and then most people don't even know that existed. The committee recommended to do away with that. Law enforcement said that'd be fine with them as well, so we made that recommendation. And then finally, simplify the legal calibers. We have a standard set of what's allowed, and then a half a dozen things that are accepted. So we'd ask to simplify the regulations just to be 22 center fire or greater, which simplify the regulations just to be 22 center fire or greater, which lines us up with North Dakota, South Dakota, Missouri, Michigan, and Wisconsin for legal calibers. So it really doesn't do anything different than what the other Midwestern states are doing, and just makes it a lot easier to understand. We've been taking public input. We had, I think it's going to be a 10 or 11 meetings around the state. We've gotten all but 2 of those completed, and we're actually running pretty broad support for the recommendations for eliminating the consolidating the licenses, in other words, moving away from those multi-zone bus and all-season deer and all those other zone licenses. We've got 89% support right now from our public meetings. To compress the zones from 6 to 2, we're running about 81% support. To simplify the tagging, and I don't know why this one isn't 100%, but it's only 93. And then the caliber restriction, simplifying that, is running 71%. So for public meetings, it's actually pretty good. I've been pretty impressed. We've got anywhere from responses on the surveys right around 300 people so far. So it's getting pretty good attendance given gas prices and other things that are going on, and pretty broad support. So that's it in a nutshell. They did make some other recommendations, and I would say that this team did a very good job, and they came at it with a lot of similar recommendations right out of the gate. So the ones they made were really broadly endorsed by everyone. That's all I had real briefly.
Other questions? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Cornicelli, I think these are good recommendations. I have a related question on deer regulations, and we've talked about this. Does the department have the authority, as the ELS vendor chooses not to ask a required question repeatedly, do they have the authority to stop using that vendor as a contractee?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, it will be more clear when the next contracting cycle starts in 2009. As we talked about, we did have an issue with compliance among agents not asking the vendors and donation question. They bypassed right through it. We do, when the next contracting cycle gets going, I think we're going to have a little bit better handle on compliance as it happens and be able to have one-on-one conversations with those agents. But it definitely was an issue to the Venison Donation Program, just like it is with other optional questions that we have. So the answer is yes.
And, sir, as a possible, you do not need any additional legislative authority right now. You can take action through your contractual process.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, yes, I believe that's true.
Question about this amendment.
Madam Chair, this simplification was explained very nicely, but what hasn't been explained nicely is the cost. And since this is the Finance Committee, I'd like for the department to go over the cost of this simplification. I'm not saying that I am in disagreement over the simplification, but the way that Senator Saxog and I have approached this is about $2 million cheaper than what their proposal is. So the way the bill is drafted now, there's somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000 impact to the fund by lack of selling licenses. And this is some number that's substantially larger, so I think we ought to hear something about that if it suits the chair.
If it suits the chair, we always want to talk about money. But I'm not understanding you, Representative. Are you for the amendment or opposed to the amendment?
Well, I think from a simple perspective of simplifying things, I think that it's a great amendment. But I'm concerned about the dollar amount, and I guess that's your that concerns us all. But it's expensive, so I'd like for him to give some testimony on the cost of it. And it seems like when we are sometimes. Simpler isn't necessarily better, especially if you're on a tight budget. And I think this, one of my other bills I talked about a few moments ago that came from a special fund, we're on a pretty tight budget, and here we're willing to give away maybe a couple of million dollars to simplify. So
all right.
I'm kind of just a little bit feel like a teeter-totter that hasn't found its equilibrium yet. And when I'm heavy on one end, it's hard to get enough load on the other end to make it equilibrium. So.
Well, if DNR can start by telling us what fund they're affecting.
Madam Chair and members, this would affect the Game and Fish Fund. The fees from deer licenses go into the Game and Fish Fund. There's a portion that's in a dedicated, there's a couple of pieces of those fees that go into dedicated accounts, but the funds that would be affected would be just the overall Game and Fish operating fund. And I understand where Representative Gill is coming from because we've been on that same teeter-totter of, you know, simplification. And Mr. Cornicelli pointed out that his charge and his committee were asked just to look at straight-up deer management and simplification of regulations and not to take into account potential fiscal impacts. But after he got done, we recognized immediately there would be some fiscal impacts. And just to explain what's happened, the all-season deer license started out as an all-season buck license with one tag, and then it became an all-season deer license, and there was another tag, and then there's been several amendments to it over the year. It now has three tags, but it allows the hunter to hunt in the archery, the firearms, or the muzzleloader season. It's the only legal way right now that a person can hunt firearms in muzzleloader season, and that's one of the reasons it's become a popular license out of our 450,000 or so deer hunters. Or is it 550,000 deer hunters? About 75,000 are purchasing the all-season license. And because it's good for three seasons, it costs three times what a regular license. So instead of paying $26, we have 75,000 hunters now that are paying $78 for the all-season license. And that number has been growing fairly rapidly over the last 8 years or so that we've had that license. So that has resulted in $2 million plus a year increase in revenue to the Game and Fish Fund since that license was established. It was a legislative initiative to establish that license. We think it's been a fine license. It's provided a lot of opportunity and certainly a lot of revenue. But in some ways, that revenue was unexpected and somewhat of a windfall to us. We really haven't sought an appropriation of that. It contributed, though, to the health of the Game and Fish Fund. Because that license has so many options, it adds a lot of complexity to the regulations, because we have the basic regulations, and then it's unless you have an all-season license, unless you have a multi-zone license, and so it just has added a great deal of complexity to explaining what you can and can't do. The concept that Mr. Cornicelli explained is more of an a la carte. You buy, if you want to hunt the muzzleloader season, you buy a muzzleloader. If you want to hunt the firearms, you buy a firearm. You can't do that right now. So it's more, it allows the hunter to more tailor what they purchase to what they really want. We've looked at, Mr. Cornicelli has looked at all season license buyers, and by looking at deer they register and projecting success rates, because we don't know exactly what seasons are hunting, but we estimate that about 25,000 of those 75,000 are hunting the archery season, about 30,000 are hunting the muzzleloader season. So they're paying in that $78 fee for some options that they're not using, that they would no longer have to if they could buy those licenses a la carte, and that's where the fiscal impact comes in. You start multiplying 25,000 times $26 and 30,000 times $26, and it comes out to be a couple of million dollars lost revenue to the fund. At the same time, though, we've got an imbalance in revenue and expenditures between hunting and fishing that we're trying to deal with. We're not saying that we would do this to solve that, but it would push that imbalance gap closer together if we lose this revenue. It's hard. It's, you know, like I said, we recognize it's teeter-totter because we don't like to lose revenue that people are voluntarily contributing. But we think a simpler system that allows people to buy what they want and not buy what they don't want makes some sense. We have to swallow pretty hard to propose doing that and lose $2 million a year in revenue. The reference that Representative Bill made to the half million is in the fiscal note, the draft fiscal note that I understand people, you know, it's not final and people haven't had a chance to look at, but there's a provision in the bill as it currently exists that would allow a person to buy an all firearms license, which would mean it would be good for muzzleloader and firearms season. And because then they wouldn't have to pay for an archery license, they didn't want, like they do with the all season license now, that would reduce revenue by about $500,000, and that was the reference that Representative Bill was making to the difference between the bill as it sits before the committee and if this amendment were adopted.
I'm willing, Madam Chair, to put the amendment in. It's on the other hand, I don't believe that your amendment hasn't been adopted in the Senate side in the bill, has it not?
It is in the Senate bill as it sits today.
This amendment?
Yes.
Then, Madam Chair, I'd like to withdraw the amendment. Because we'll have to hash this out when we get to a place where there's negotiations going on. Because I've been taken to the woodshed a lot of times for trying to spend money, and now we're trying to, you know, there's $2 million on the table here.
I think it would be helpful, Representative Bill, if you could explain to us what you intend to do. And it's fine. If you would explain to us what you think the options should be to this proposal, do you mind explaining that?
Well, the idea of being able to buy exactly what you want, as the department has suggested, would have quite a bit of, would be attractive to some. What we have done is we've made it so that you buy an all-season firearms license, which would include, in the way the bill is drafted without the amendment, we would have it so that you could buy an all-season firearms license, which would include muzzleloader and firearms. And then if you'd like to buy archery, you'd buy that separately. So that dropping off the archery part, which I believe is $26, is that the amount, $26? we end up costing the fund by making archery optional rather than making all season, which includes archery, muzzleloader, and firearm. By making archery optional, we cost the fund $500,000. By them breaking it into three different things, which is archery, muzzleloader, and firearm, then you could buy any of the three, and it would cost the fund $2.5 million. So we like the idea of leaving the all-season firearms like we have it drafted and having only $500,000 in impact. I tried to explain it clearly. Now, there are things, Madam Chair, in the amendment that I like. There are some things in here that don't cost anything. But I'm not prepared to move an amendment like that at the moment.
It seems to me that there would be another option, too, to have them separate but make it revenue neutral by raising the fee on each. And I assume people have thought about that. So.
Well, Madam Chair, and that's the reason I think that when we get to a point to begin kind of negotiating this, that we might be able to look at some different things. And I'm not criticizing the work because Mr. Carnicelli, he was directed to just do something to simplify and not take fiscal impact into play.
Okay. Any more questions from members? I think we need to move on. Representative Jill withdraws 1439, I believe it is. Is that right? Mm-hmm. 1439. Okay,
then the next amendment, Madam Chair, is the 786 amendment, and that has to do with the Cornish provisions in the bill regarding the ELS and a charge for using electronic bank cards. And this is a change from when, that's on page 3. And the amendment deletes Section 3 and then inserts a new Section 3 with a Subdivision 4, as you can see in the amendment. It does essentially the same thing, except it makes it more clear exactly what the intent is. And the intent is to allow up to $3.50 charge for the and posting it on a sign informing the individuals of the fee near the point of payment that has to be clearly invisible. And this is to make up, someone comes in and buys a $100 license, which is not unusual, and they use a credit card. They get hit with a transaction fee plus a percentage, and they have to take it out of the end. They have to take it out of their end. So if you're a Representative Simpson and you're selling licenses, he's not on this committee. He's the one that pays the $3.50 or whatever the amount is, just for providing the license to the public. So that's what this did. This has been called for over and over and over and over and over. And then the last part of the amendment, which is on the other side, line 2.8. Clarifies something that happened last year regarding the placement of feed and what defines feed. And maybe Mr. Boggess can come up and quickly explain that little piece. It has to do with the bill that was passed last year regarding feeding on adjacent lands and not having any knowledge of it and some things like that. And there was some in-the-field technical problems that occurred with the way the bill was worded, so this takes care of it, Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Bogus.
Madam Chair and members, Ed Bogus again. And Ms. Watts is here from our enforcement division if you need more detail, but there's a pending court case where a person harvested food. We exempt food that's growing in a food plot or under ordinary or normal agricultural practices from the baiting provision. We have a pending court case right now where a person harvested the food from a food plot and then placed it as bait, and it's a potential loophole in the language that we're just trying to already in the bill is some cleanup of language that passed last year. This was put into statute rather than into rule, and to address an issue that actually Representative Moe had with a constituent who had someone baiting on adjacent property in a way that caused his property to become unhuntable. So language was passed last year to fix that problem, and we're in the bill as it is unamended, we're just kind of cleaning up some of that language, and the amendment today further cleans it up based on this pending court case.
So I view that portion, Madam Chair, as technical.
Members have questions about A6. Representative Scalzi, and then
Mr. Chair, regarding the charge, I thought that was prevented by federal law. I could be wrong, but I didn't know that you could add a charge to an electronic transfer. I thought that the credit card companies had put together some kind of law that was enacted by the federal government that would prevent that. Does anyone here know? I'm not sure.
Madam Chair, I don't know anything about the federal government having some prohibition about it. We had this bill. This has been around for all session. It's been discussed in other sessions, and I just recently had another bill in another committee that had to do with fees on credit cards, which is now on the general register. And none of the credit card companies, and I consulted with all of them, had any complaints about that one. And I have heard nothing from any credit card company regarding this one. So I can't directly answer the question, but this year seems to be my credit card year.
Mr. Meyer, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, DNR. Representative Scalzi, or Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, I think what you may be referring to is the state under contract with Wells Fargo is prohibited from charging a specific fee for any credit card transaction. The testimony that we had heard, I think, from Representative Cornish on this issue was that at this point in time, one of the major credit card companies still has that as far as individual vendors, but two other of the major credit card companies, or maybe three, don't have that prohibition on people being able to charge transaction costs. The language that we have here is to clarify that we charge $1.50 for transaction costs on our electronic licenses, which covers some of the internet costs and all those costs that are on there. And the language as drafted in the original bill, the original amendment, would conflict with that. So we're just clarifying what the $3.50 charge is for the electronic transaction, and then that a ELS vendor has the ability to charge up to a $3.50 credit card convenience fee, if I guess the way to look at it. It'll bring open place market trading. It'll be the bigger vendors who do not do it, and people will know that. So it's
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question might be for Mr. Bogus. Mr. Bogus, on the page 18, line 24. If I remember right, in the case of like a sweet corn field, if the producer ends up not harvesting it, as oftentimes happens, might be a second crop, sweet corn, or they end up not using it all. If I remember right, it's the feed and baiting. If I remember right, they don't consider that harvest if it's just plowed under. This almost looks like it might clarify. Would that in that game warden that you often refer to, Representative Dill, he must have moved from my district. Because,
is it a very efficient game warden?
Correct. I don't know if he moves around or if there's more than one of them. But in the case of this, it was a sweet corn field that was just under, and it was not harvested, but it was considered fading then. Does this clarify that, or maybe I'm not
Madam
clear?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, it probably not, because I think the situation you're referring to is a waterfowl baiting definition, which is different than a deer baiting definition. So this really isn't going to help with that issue.
Madam Chair, I'd like to remove 7A6 so we can get it adopted into the bill. Because we didn't.
You're going to move it again.
Well,
you said remove.
Let's take a vote on it.
And remove last time meant take it away. In this case, Representative Bill moved A6. I see no questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. Remove is not the greatest word.
Okay. The next one is 47A7. And this has to do with transporting fish that, I'll let Mr. Boggs explain it. So I'll move with the 47A7 amendment.
A7 has been moved. Mr. Boggs.
Madam Chair and members, I'll try to explain it, but that doesn't mean I agree with it.
Okay, well then we're in a different situation here.
This was an amendment that we were working with Representative Dill and his staff on at their request to allow possession of fish on special management or experimental waters. These are waters that have regulations that are different than the statewide bag limits, or they have special slot limits or bag limits. And so this would allow possession of fish on those waters to be prepared as a meal either on the ice or on the shore for a shore lunch. If the fish were lawfully taken, have been packaged by a licensed fish packer, and do not otherwise exceed daily possession limits. So if they're on a special or management water that has a limit that's lower than the statewide limit, if we use walleye as the probably most likely example, if they're on a water that has a limit of 2 walleye, for example, like Upper Red Lake, and they have other fish that they want to bring onto that water for a lunch on the ice or on the shore, they could bring fish that were packed by a fish packer as long as they don't exceed the statewide limits for those fish. So this would have some limited application on lakes that have limits that are less than the statewide limit, and if they have some fish that were packed at the if the resort was a licensed fish packer, they could bring those fish out so they'd have enough for a nice shore lunch. I believe that's what this amendment does. I'm not sure if that was the author's intent.
This tracks back to the very efficient conservation officer again, the same one that causes the problems routinely. And on the lakes up in Voyagers Park, as an example, they have special regulations. And so the people will catch fish, take them in, the licensed fish packer will pack them, label them, and prepare them for shipment. But then on the next day, they decide that they want to take those fish out onto the lake and take them on a shore lunch. And they apparently there's some problem with that. Between the time that they take them from the resort while they're traveling across the lake and they're not tied up to the shoreline. So if they were out fishing in between the time that they left the resort and the time that they had the shore lunch, they would be in violation of some regulations. And it's happened over and over and over again. And so that is the purpose of the amendment. Also, on the page 2, beginning on line 2.12, talks about what is required on a fish packer's license, that it be on the fish that is packed by the particular fish packer. Right now, the label has to be so big. If you have 2 walleyes in a package, you have to have a you have to have box it specially because it has requires so much information that you can't get it on the package. And so we're trying to streamline that down some.
I would like for the committee to hear the objections that Mr. Bogus has, and I am looking at the rulemaking issue, even though they're exempt from some rulemaking provisions. There, my guess is we will get a fiscal note on this rulemaking portion, and so that's always worrisome. That the rulemaking portion, Mr. Bogus, could you just help explain why you made the comment you did that while you were could explain it, you weren't supporting it?
Madam Chair, I wasn't sure if we were supporting it. I guess I would ask Ms. Watts, who worked on this language. I just consulted with her briefly. It sounds like our main concerns perhaps have been addressed, but maybe if she could come up and just say if we still have any remaining concerns, if that's okay with the committee.
And my concern would be the cost, yes. Welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee, my name is Pat Watts. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources Enforcement Division. And we did work with Representative Dill's staff on the language, and the pieces that we felt were critical that they were willing to put back in. Some examples, you know, wanted the name and license number of the angler or other person who lawfully possessed the fish. They did work with us. The worst of it is acceptable at this point. We do have concerns about possessing fish on the water, but it is limited to fish that are packed by fish packers. So there's been some efforts to limit.
Are there questions, members?
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Anzus, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Dill, I just want to be have it really, really clear in my mind.
Don't leave it. This is a question for you.
I want to make it really, really clear in my mind for enforcement reasons that the aggregate number of fish by species added together cannot exceed the possession limit for that particular body of water. Is that...
Madam Chair, Representative, what the packaging and the labeling will allow is possession of more fish than you should technically have on that body of water, but not an over limit of what number of fish you can possess. In other words, you could take the fish that you caught on Mille Lacs, take them up to Upper Red Lake, and you could use those fish that you caught down on Mille Lacs for your shoreline. Even, you know, you could still catch your two on Upper Red Lake. So overall, you're not exceeding the limits that you're able to possess, but you are temporarily possessing more fish than under current regulations you could have on that body of water. But you wouldn't be exceeding the number of fish you can possess overall. Oh dear.
Madam Chair, it's not oh dear because, for example, you could be fishing on Rainy Lake today, or Rainy River today, have the fish packaged by a fish packer that is licensed, is recognized as an honorable individual. He can package them, say where they were caught. Then you could take your boat on the trailer over to Rainy Lake, which is only a matter of a mile or two, and go on Rainy Lake and then be cited for a violation because you now are. Even though there are two different limits, you are now in violation because you have the fish on Rainy Lake. And so that's the problem. You could go, for example, in Voyageurs National Park and you could catch two walleyes in Little Trout Lake, and then you could go over to the border waters. Those fish were packed overnight by your local resort and decide that you've got your kids going along and want to have a shoreline, so you need the fish from the previous day, and now you would get a ticket. Now, the strange thing is the way I understand it, if you're on shore, with a fish, you're not illegal. But if you're on the water, you are. So, I mean, let's be realistic here. We need to have some additional regulations so that we don't have this very, very, very efficient game warden ticketing families out who are just trying to legally take fish and then feed their families.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Dill. I want it to be really clear and on the record that the department's literal interpretation of what Representative Dill is trying to accomplish is in sync here, so that there isn't any communication issues down the road a bit between the agency and conservation officers. I'm not feeling real clear in my mind that we've reached that clarity yet. Maybe it's because I'm not grasping it, or maybe it's because I can conjure up all sorts of nuances to this that folks will get involved with. And what we find, unfortunately, is conservation officers left to their own devices will make interpretations that cause anglers' problems.
Well, Madam Chair, in just discussing this with the Division of Enforcement here, Ms. Watts, they'll be training their conservation officers on what's proper and what's not proper. And you would concur with that. This is a problem, members. That is a problem out there, and people are being cited for doing something that's perfectly legitimate. And this is the intent to clarify that.
Members, do you have any other questions?
And the last comment on the thing, and maybe I don't understand, but Madam Chair, on the cost on line 2.22, it says that the rules required to do this are exempt from the rulemaking process.
But it also continues to say, as part of this rulemaking, the commissioner shall. This is not something I weigh in on. We will just get a fiscal note.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So I'd like to have a vote on this then.
Representative Dill moves A7. I see no further questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? That amendment is adopted. The next amendment?
Okay, the next one is the 47A8 amendment. And it's regarding carbon monoxide detectors. I think Representative McNamara wants to move the amendment. And then I've got just a very short oral amendment.
Madam Chair, I would like to move the AA amendment. Madam Chair, I did move the AA amendment, and I believe Representative Dill wanted to make a small oral amendment. Maybe I could just say real quick, Madam Chair, I did look over the statute. As many members may know, and some won't because they weren't here in 2006, I sponsored legislation that became law that requires carbon monoxide detectors in homes, in dwellings. I believe the legislation does require carbon monoxide detectors in fish houses that are designed to be slept in overnight. This is some clarifying legislation that would help maybe people remember that in fish houses being used to sleep in overnight or deer hunting shacks, the need to have carbon monoxide detectors. Unfortunately, there was an accident down in Representative Ruth's district where two people lost their lives in a fish house. And so that's what the bill's about. And then Representative Dill and I have been talking, and I believe he recently has mentioned he may have an oral amendment.
Representative Dill.
All right, Madam Chair, we're having another amendment drafted as we, Mr. Meyer. The first amendment would be on line 1.6. That it would read, in a dark house, comma, fish house, or shelter. And that would then be consistent with that would be then consistent with the bill, because in the bill, Without this amendment, it does some clarification of shelters and over structures that are overnight, okay, and those types of things. So in a dark house, comma, fish house, or shelter that is left on the ice would be the First Amendment.
Do members understand the amendment? Are there questions? I don't see any questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Your next amendment?
On the same line, 1.6, now after shelter, that is offered for rental and is left. It was after the word shelter, it would say that is offered for rent and that is left on the ice overnight. So this would be only then would limit it to those fish house structures or shelters or dark houses that are offered out for rental. The reason I'm doing this, adding this amendment, members, is not that I'm not concerned about just about, you know, everyone, but I think that we need to take this incrementally. The fit, and maybe next year look at it, making it even more broad, is that the fish houses that are offered out for rental are normally taken out on the, let's use Lake of the Woods and Representative Van Zyl's district. They are put out on the ice. They're left there the entire year. Fish houses that are more portable and moved around, I can see these things being bounced around and ending up not operable, and the batteries taken out of them to use transistor radio and all of the other things that will happen. And I'd like to just take this incrementally. So if we can offer it for rental only the first from now for the next year, we'll take it up later.
Okay. Members understand the amendment? Are you agreeable with that, Representative McNamara?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Dill, this may be a little different. You and I talked, and I didn't have big feelings on it. I actually, after looking at the original bill and law that passed in 2006, I am somewhat concerned that if we had this last language, it may lead people to believe that they're not under the current law. I actually think that the fish houses being used to sleep in overnight currently are required to have carbon monoxide detectors. So, I'll just leave it up to body. Whatever the folks here decide, I personally am going to be voting no on the
Chair. I haven't read that. Why don't we just drop the amendment that I just proposed, and Representative McNamara and I'll work this out before we, you know, do the final thing on it. Because if it's conflicting, I don't want to make it confusing.
Okay.
So they're actually the only amendment then is the one that we've already adopted.
Okay. Do members have questions about this amendment? I don't see any questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any nays? No nays. The amendment is adopted.
The last one, Madam Chair, would be the 47A9. And this comes to me from Representative Olin. I'd like to move the amendment, and then I'd like to have Mr. Boggess come up and explain that. Just in your section, right? Yeah. I got it right here.
Yes, perfect.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was distracted with another issue. When we passed this, the last previous amendment, I know we've added it to the bill, but I have a question for the author. Can I ask that question?
You certainly may.
Representative Bill, what's the enforcement of this? I mean, you represent a lot of the same people I do, and we're asking them to have carbon monoxide detectors. Danny, maybe Representative McNamara can answer this. Resorts, you know, who are challenged to provide the services that they already have to provide. Are we going to be fining them? Are we going to, go fishermen out there with their fish house? You know, I mean, you maybe had a couple beers and so you stay out all night and you don't have a carbon monoxide detector. You know, are you going to force them to go into town? I mean, are we actually, is the efficient conservation officer up north actually going to be checking this stuff out? I guess I know we've already passed this, but I'm somewhat concerned about it.
Okay. I think that felt rhetorical to me at this point, and you will be talking with Representative Dill as we go along. Okay.
Madam Chair, if you want, I could address
Representative Moe's question, there is no fine under the current law for carbon monoxide detectors.
Members, I am looking at the clock. We're out as soon as 6 o'clock, so, or it's actually 5 minutes, so we're going to finish right quickly here.
We're down that we have, I've moved the 47A9. Thank you.
All right. And would you explain it quickly?
Yes. Mr. Boggess is going to come explain it.
Madam Chair, members, this amendment would help us deal with the bovine TB area in northwestern Minnesota. A couple of years ago, there was legislative direction to establish a feeding ban or a feeding restriction within a 15-mile radius of any TB-positive cattle herd. This amendment would simply expand that to a 30-mile radius of the tuberculosis management zone as identified by the commissioner. We have a specific zone permit area that we've established for liberalized hunting and other special hunts. And so this would, we actually have some broad rulemaking authority for restricting feeding to manage disease. So the current feeding restriction applies in a broader area than just a 15-mile radius because we followed roads and lakes and things like that. So this would be a moderate expansion in that feeding ban zone, and we're fully supportive of this.
Okay. Any questions for members? I don't see any questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Thank you. We will lay this bill over for consideration.
Sorry for so many amendments, Madam Chair, but I'm learning that this is just the way it is on these.
Okay. Representative Beacon, you have House File 3273.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I would like to move House File 3273 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And this is the DNR technical bill, and some of the more substantive provisions in it include Section 1, Paragraph H, where they added a provision to prohibit a person under the age of 16 from operating an ATV on public lands or waters or Grand Made trails if the person cannot properly reach the control and handlebars and reach the foot pegs while sitting upright. We have in Section 8, there was a change which modifies the responsibility for a campfire by adding a person who maintains the campfire. It had only been originally the responsibility of the person who started it. Section 9, it removes the requirement that maps be prepared on a scale where 4 inches equals 1 mile. Also modifies the process that the property owner may use to appeal a state forest road map. As far as Section 11, this allows flexibility in acquiring public water access sites by removing restrictions that it be no more than 7 acres. This is, I guess, brought on as a result of some concern about restricted public access as a result of public resorts and private resorts. Those are the more substantive issues. The others really are clarifications of names and clarification of terms. And I have Mr. Meyer here also to answer any questions that members may have.
Any questions, members? This will be laid over for consideration. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Boggess.
But thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any fiscal impact?
There is a fiscal note on this, and it has some expenses and some costs and a net cost. So we will balance it out in the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
So we lay this over for consideration. Members, do you have any other things before us with Representative Hackbar?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. On this bill, I was going to offer an amendment, Madam Chair.
I've already laid it over, Representative Hackbar.
Okay. Do I speak to the bill?
Absolutely.
And issue? I'm not going to have an amendment. I was going to talk about the amendment I was going to offer. And it is an area of concern, something that happened last year, and when a bill came back from conference committee, the issue happened, and I don't think anybody in the House knew about it. The issue was talked about in the Senate, and it was put into the bill in the conference committee, and we really didn't know what we were doing. As so often happens when bills come back to the conference committee. And this is an issue about creating seasons for ATV use. And this was put in the bill, and I think everybody's kind of dumbfounded later after this bill passes, and here all of a sudden we have this new law where the commissioners have to create the ATV season and to create these map trails. And this was something that Senator Chauvet put in the bill, and I think a lot of us were kind of shocked that it was there. Madam Chair, this is an issue that I'm not going to let go, and I think it has to come back for some further consideration. I don't want to offer an amendment to this bill, but I'm not going to at this time. You already laid it over anyway. But this is something that needs to be talked about, because this is very, very serious, and it was just kind of glanced over last session. So I think we need to talk about this issue. It's going to have to come back at some time. So I just wanted to make that statement, Madam Chair. And also, as long as I have the floor, Madam Chair, we're laying these bills over, and it's for possible inclusion into the big omnibus bill. Is that where we're going to stick to?
We don't have all the fiscal notes yet.
Right.
And we have to cut $3 million something in this biennium and six for the next. And right now we don't have that yet. And the proposals made by the governor's office do not meet that. So one of the things I was going to do is offer members to either email me or Mr. Reinholz or Ms. Taylor about possible things that we should be doing to meet the our obligation to reduce tails by a substantial amount, that's $6 million. So I'm going to give you those. I will give you my telephone number at home. Or actually, I'll give you my cell phone number if folks have thoughts, because we are going on holiday, and I think we are leaving a lot of responsibility. And that is 612-799-5008. And if folks want to talk about any of this, we will have, as soon as we come back, we will have a proposed bill on the table, and you will see then a lot of the bills then going out after we have reconciled the finances, which we cannot do yet.
And I'm sure those $50 from, not from dedicated funds, but from general fund money. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how we will reconcile all of this yet at this point. I mean, I cannot tell you how we will make that proposal yet, Representative Tackler.
Well, maybe Ms. Reinholz could answer that question. Does that money have come from general fund dollars, not from dedicated dollars? Is that correct?
Yeah, Chair,
I'm sorry, I did not hear the question. Oh, I think I can answer it.
Okay.
We will have to make that kind of saving from general fund. That is
right.
If that's the question. Okay.
So I'm just saying that, Chair, so if people have suggestions, the suggestions should come from dollars that are spent from the general fund.
Yeah, you bet. With that, members, we're supposed to be out of here 1 minute ago, and meeting is adjourned.